It's time for Twig This Week in Google. We have a great show. I'm so excited. Stacey Higginbotham, Jeff Jarvis, and Mike Elgin. The entire gang is assembled. We're going to talk about the massive $5 billion fine leveled against Google by the EU. Is it kosher? Well, some agree, some don't agree. Mark Zuckerberg's surprising statements about Facebook's policies and a whole lot more coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 465, recorded Wednesday, July 18th, 2018. Cindy and Dindy. This Week in Google is brought to you by Wink, the best way to discover new wines you'll love. Go to trywink.com/twig and get $20 off your first shipment. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Oh, I am really excited about our episode this week. Everybody's here. I mean, everybody. Jeff Jarvis back from DLD. He's calling from his home office, glowing like an angel. What is that? What is that? His T-shirt says Johannes Gutenberg, 1400 to 1468. Aww.
I went to the mines, back to the Gutenberg Museum, where I also got a facsimile Gutenberg Bible.
Oh, wow. Can you read that?
Folks.
It's in, like, not only is it in German, it's like in old German script.
It's in Latin.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They didn't translate it in those
very
days.
Few spaces.
Yeah, no vernacular. That's right. Was that before they used punctuation and spaces?
No, they had some. I'm reading a book. I just found out that when the various things of punctuation were invented, the period, the comma, which actually started as a slash, the exclamation point, they were first used at various points.
It's really cool. I find that fascinating.
It's all fascinating. Yeah, it's all absolutely fascinating.
That's because we're kind of weird word geeks.
Yeah, we are.
Stacey Higginbotham is also here. It's great to have Stacey visiting us from the Pacific Northwest, where she has escaped the climate of Austin, Texas.
Woohoo!
I think that's disloyal, Stacey.
No, it's not. Most Texans go to Colorado.
I think there's a problem.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, we decamp. It's 105 there this week, guys.
Oh, yay.
Do you have to keep the air conditioning on a certain level in the house so it doesn't, like, fry?
So it doesn't boil my fish? Yes.
No.
It's dangerous being a fish in Austin. And I'm really thrilled to have Mike Elgin in studio with me.
Mike Elgin is thrilled to be here.
We love having Mike here. Mike is a peripatetic global traveler, gastronomad, as we call it, a gastronomad.
And he has a new hairdo.
A new hairdo,
yes. A different look.
That's right. Short. That's right.
Really?
Yeah.
Ish. Okay.
You crew-cutted it.
Yeah.
And you're very tanned.
Yes. I've been in the sun a lot.
Where have you been?
We have recently been in Italy, France, and Switzerland. Jeez. Hot in all of the above.
Even Switzerland.
Even Switzerland was hot. Wow. It was like 80s, low 80s in the
and
Alps.
And you're home to visit Princess Squishy Face?
We are here to visit Princess Squishy Face and bask in her celestial cuteness.
Aww.
Yeah.
Aww. That's so nice. It's great. I always really appreciate it. Mike brought us a nice bottle of wine from a region.
What kind?
Provence. It's a Chateau Unang. It's a red. It's a Grenache Syrah blend that Leo and Lisa are going to love.
It's a varietal I've never had. What was it? Ventoux? I can't remember.
Ventoux is the appellation. It's a pretty small appellation in Southern Rhone.
I can't wait.
Yeah. So you're going to love it.
Awesome. We are gathered together to speak of the $5 billion fine that was just leveled at Google. And I'm really curious. We had a debate. In fact, it got a little heated on Windows Weekly this morning because I think this is really kind of appalling. But I'd like to hear what you all think. The European Commission says there were three things that caused it to do this fine. Three things that Google must correct in the next 90 days. It's abused its Android market dominance. It's all about Android in three ways. Bundling its search engine and Chrome apps into the operating system. Number one. Blocking phone makers. This is one I agree with. Blocking phone makers from creating devices that run forked versions of Android. Google, Android is open source. Anybody can use it. Amazon has, of course. Amazon is based, the Fire operating system is Android, but It doesn't have the Google Play Store or any of the Google services on it. And that's legal. It's legit. If you want the Google Play Store, you have to have Chrome, and the default search has to be Google in the phone. And this is the one that I disagree with. I think Google overstepped their bounds. They also apparently told phone makers, if you want Google services on your phones, you can't make any phones with pure Android. You can't make a non-Google phone. And then finally, and this is something Google had stopped a few years ago, made payments to certain large manufacturers and mobile network operators to exclusively bundle the search app on handsets. Google apparently learned about the EU investigation 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and stopped doing that at that time. So really, two things Google still does, apparently. They must stop in the next three months. Google says they will appeal. And actually, I thought there was quite a good blog post by Sundar Pichai in which he said Google has, or Android rather, has created more choice.
Amen.
Yeah. And the, of course, the Windows people are going to be in favor of all of this because Windows, this is comparable in many ways to the antitrust attack on Microsoft in the 90s, bundling Internet Explorer, because, of course, that guaranteed that Internet Explorer would dominate everything, which was turned out to be.
Oh, I put a story up on the rundown, Mike, that goes into why it's different.
Yeah,
we actually talked about this last week and why it was different. And Leo, I felt like you explained that pretty well.
I wish I could remember what I said.
Was it Kevin? Explained it pretty well. It was basically along the lines of this is at the operating system. No, it wasn't at the operating system level.
Well, so here, the biggest, now, of course, Mike covered this.
Yes, I mean,
you were editor in chief of Windows Magazine at the time. Yeah. Right. We covered it. It was exactly the DOJ investigation of Microsoft started when we launched Tech TV in 1998. And so we covered that for 6 years because that went on and on, and then later EU's action. I still don't think it's such a bad thing to bundle the browser in the operating system.
It's irrelevant. But the biggest difference, I think, is that the purpose of Windows was to behave as a platform for
others'
apps. The purpose of Android is to get Google search in the people's hands. That Android exists probably because Google wants to make the world safe for its search engine and doesn't want just Apple taking over other companies. Because if there was no Android, right, and there were Symbian or whatever operating systems one could imagine for smartphones, they could all just say, well, you know what? Google's too dominant. We just won't have Google. We won't let Google on. And so that's why they came out with Android.
Well, I don't frankly like a world where there's iOS and Symbian is not a world I want to live in.
No, because it would be iOS.
I think it's more than just getting the browser in hands, though obviously from a business perspective. But I think it was really about trying to create a competitive marketplace. And by making it free, I mean, that's the problem, that antitrust laws are so outdated. What in other times would look like dumping is instead a great favor to consumers by making this free and getting more low-priced phones out there. And I also think Google doesn't do the wrong thing in requiring manufacturers to either do authorized Android or unauthorized Android. But to do both is going to be really brand confusing. And all this talk we hear about fragmentation, that would be even worse. So I think Google's perfectly right.
Stacey, go ahead.
Oh, no. I actually agree with Jeff on this, which is, whoa.
You had to say actually agree.
Well, you know, there are topics, Jeff, where we disagree, but this one I'm with you. And I remember last week we kind of came to this conclusion. I think it's a good one, which is we don't have the antitrust infrastructure right now or the rules to govern the way we build hardware, software, and technology businesses today. So I think that's probably where we should take this focus.
In the U.S., this isn't an issue because Android and iOS are roughly at parity, about 50% each. Right. So neither is dominant. There's no monopoly position. So it's not an issue. Apparently, in the EU, Google has not only 80% of all the search, it has 75% of all the phones.
Yeah.
So it is, I don't know if that's a monopoly, but it is fairly dominant. And the EU, and Jeff, you're the expert on EU antitrust law, seems to favor competition among companies. And so feels like that Google's dominant position makes it hard for others to compete.
Well,
I celebrate the fact that Google bought Android and kept it open source.
Yeah. Amen.
And they offer it for free to a lot of people. And if you would like the Google services, it doesn't seem to me unreasonable if you want the Play Store to say, well, you got to include Google services, which it's includes quality Chrome. Yeah, and right. That, by the way, that's driven by consumer demand. Consumers prefer an Android device with Google's Play Store on it than not. So consumers are saying that.
And it gives them an easier, I mean, if you have to make a slightly different version of your app for like the Android App Store, for example, that's going to eliminate choice in apps and make it more difficult for developers and quote unquote innovation, that's where we're going to focus our innovation.
So the way I look at it is there are two big issues. One is market dominance and the other is kind of lock-in. The whole assumption about market dominance is that you can exclude others from the marketplace.
Or use your dominance in one market to enter other markets.
And their other action against Google was very much like that in
with terms shopping.
Exactly. But here you have the two dominant operating systems, iOS and Android. And on the one hand, you have iOS, which is completely dominant. You know, you cannot install iOS on a phone that is not Apple's phone.
And you can put Chrome on iOS, but it's not the default browser.
And you can't get an app that's not approved.
And as Sundar Pichai points out, 1,300 companies are running Android. Yeah. It is a very open system. There's a free version. It's creating all this, all these other companies, including the most direct competitor to Google, which is Amazon. Amazon uses the free version of Android to basically compete directly against Google. So Amazon has all kinds of alternatives to the Google Play Store, to the content that Google is selling and stuff like that. And Google just allows this. That's how open they are. Their most direct competitor is basing their entire platform on Android, on the free version of Android. Like, if that isn't open, I don't know what is. You know, if that isn't a generous policy, I guess, for lack of a better term, I don't know what is. And Apple, you couldn't imagine anything like that from Apple.
No, you couldn't.
You can't uninstall Safari, but Sundar Pichai has on his blog post a GIF that shows you can remove Chrome from Android and install Opera in under 30 seconds.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, it seems to me the opposite of anti-competitive, but...
And the browser doesn't really bring them huge advantage, right? They make their money on advertising on sites.
Yeah, but the browser is what gives them Google search.
Yeah, I understood. But search is only part of what they do now. They make their money from advertising, and much of that advertising is off of search.
Yeah, it would still work on sites. Opera Mini or...
So let me go back to your point about antitrust. Of course, the key difference between the U.S. and Europe is in the U.S., it's about consumer protection. In Europe, it's about company size. And, you know, you got too big. And there's no statutory definition of too big, but there's kind of a belief. So last week I couldn't be on the show because I was in Europe doing a few things, including going to the Gutenberg Museum. But I also met with the head of CNIL, the French Data Protection Authority, and another 10 people that she brought in for a conversation. And then I met with the head of digital in the German parliament. And then I just had a conversation with UK regulators. And it's an interesting shift in time right now where, you know, I've been out there being very critical of EU regulation. And now suddenly they're willing to listen to that viewpoint.
Interesting.
And I think that what we've seen in European regulation is that they're recognizing that it's protectionist. Dorothea Bär, the German MP who spoke at this conference where I was, the publishing company that throws the conference, a DLD, an executive there did a speech beforehand in which he was trying to say, we got to be innovative, we got to be reasonable, and we got to be realistic like Jeff Jarvis. Okay, great. But then he defended the Leistungsschutzrecht. He defended the regulation they have. But then she got up as a member of parliament, and she's a conservative member of parliament. But she scolded the publishers, and she scolded them and said, this is protectionist. And it's not appropriate for the time and for the year. So there's a time right now, there's a little window I see where regulators may be open to different perspectives on this. And in France, I had a reasonable discussion too. They were considering a fake news law that has huge problems in the UK as well. So what we see happening is we see the courts with the right to be forgotten. We see the antitrust regulators with this antitrust effort, which was really pushed very hard by publishers in Germany. And then we have legislation going after things like privacy, GDPR, and hate speech and all that. So there's this huge, my second point is regulatory reflex in Europe. And when I sat down and talked to them, it was kind of, well, we're going to regulate. How should we? rather than starting and saying, well, is there a problem we should deal with?
Can I just say parenthetically, completely parenthetically, how refreshing it is to hear opposing viewpoints debated in a rational, sensible way, and then a consensus attempt to reach consensus.
Europe.
Wow. How sophisticated those Europeans are.
Amen. Amen, brother. Amen.
Jesus.
Oh, okay. It was kind of great.
It's interesting. So there is a little shift away from this.
I sense an opening. I sense it, not a shift, but an opening to have a different kind of conversation. And I welcome that tremendously. You know, and so I'm not against all regulation. I'm for smart regulation that starts with evidence of harm and evidence of issues. So the issue back to
that's Edward a good Google question. Where is the evidence of harm? That's a very good point.
Where's the harm?
Yeah,
there isn't any.
You can, as Sundar Pichai does, the CEO of Google, point out. It seems to be only benefit. You've got choice, 1,300 brands, 24,000 different devices at every price point. All of that points to a diversity that allows people choice. That's
and good. I tend to support the concept of democracy, whether it's political democracy marketplace democracy.
I used to remember what that was.
And the reason Google is so dominant as a search engine.
There is no such thing as marketplace democracy.
There is. People vote with their dollars. Yeah, and the Europeans love
a free market.
Marketplace. Yeah.
A free
market. No, but free the market. Europeans love Android, and the Europeans love Google more than in the U.S. by a long shot,
why
like you
they
said.
Buy more? They'd buy 75%. That's right.
Yeah. So it's like
you're giving people what
European,
they want.
European regulators are supposed to be representing the people of Europe. The people of Europe have spoken, as far as I'm concerned. They love
Jesus.
Google Search, and they love Android.
I never knew how easy it is to change the search engine on Chrome.
It's trivial.
On the phone.
Yeah. That's the point. Is where you've got iOS, where there is no open source version. Yeah. Only Apple can make an iOS device. You cannot uninstall the browser. You cannot change the default search. You cannot change the default browser. There's no problem with that.
Siri is completely locked in, and virtual assistants are the new search engine anyway. That's where we're.
So
that's
I'm just grateful that there is a choice. I choose to use an iPhone most of the time, but I'm just glad there is a choice for people.
Like that's a really important point too, where they keep on thinking that Google is a search company, and so they regulated to that, and then it became a phone company, and they're trying to regulate to that. And as you're pointing out, AI and voice is they're so far behind that the battleground is way ahead of them.
And that's exactly what happened with IE with Windows. By the time they cracked down on IE, IE was pretty much dead in the water.
I know. That's the irony of a lot of all of this is it takes so long that by the time they actually promulgate these rules, it's too late. Go ahead, Stacey.
No, I was going to say, if we want to start looking at AI, we need to look at how you access different data sets, how you train those data sets to believe different things and act certain ways. That would be the new kind of antitrust battle. And how do you limit your competitors' access to that data, or can they get that data in other ways?
It's true, because the battleground has shifted now. Google has a massive advantage in AI, ahead of Apple, maybe not ahead of Amazon, but
so maybe we should be looking at how they're bundling and forcing people to use Google Photos and the user agreements for, I mean,
they'll
think
do,
about
the EU will do that in 10 years. It'll be, I mean, it's.
There are plenty of ways you can get that data. It's the same thing with self-driving cars. So those are the battlegrounds of the future.
I agree.
One thing.
And maybe the thing that we should be thinking about. I don't want to see, I mean, no one wants to see a single dominant company in any of this. And that's the argument I would make. And certainly the argument Pichai makes is that Android creates choice. Mm-hmm. It's not that it's not creating choice.
So I hope Google fights the hell out of this one.
Who do you appeal to? You appeal to the European court?
Oh, that's a good question.
Vatican.
There is a process.
Vatican.
I'm not sure.
They are appealing, although unless they can get a stay, I don't know. I don't know how it works in the EU, but I would presume they have 90 days to make.
Hold on here. Confirms it will appeal. So it's a European Commission ruling.
By the way, Google's also fighting that other ruling that they got last year of several billion dollars for the Google shopping.
The biggest difference is that if it's just a fine, Google, you know, it's no big deal for Google to pay billions of dollars in fines. In this case, they have to change the whole business model for Android,
and its principle too. You know, I think they've got to. Okay, I'm going to wave a little American flag for as long as I still can, before we switch to the Russian. It's also about defending American technology companies. There's an anti-American flavor to this, yeah. anti-technology and anti-American. And I think Google has to defend both and has to point out the value and the benefits that it brings.
Yeah.
When you buy an Android phone in China, it doesn't have the Google apps on it by Google's choice, right? Google doesn't.
Well, there's a bunch of the apps are banned in China. So yeah. Gmail.
Yeah, I was
going to
say.
But you can download. I think you could still download the Google apps if you want. But it doesn't come. The Google Play Store doesn't come on there. It's like the Amazon Fire platform. You can download the Google Play Store with a simple change.
It's a little different in China. That Huawei and a couple of the other major smartphone vendors actually have Google apps on their Play Stores. So, the Huawei Play Store, you can download several Google apps, not Gmail, not. You know, some of the ones that the Communist Party doesn't like.
So, Leo, I think this is the way it works. I think that Google actually appeals to the commission and then it goes to court. So there's a quote here from European Commission saying the commission will defend its decision in court. So I think that there's probably a process and then it does go to court.
Okay. So they don't have to pay the fine or change their business yet.
I don't know that.
Yeah.
Usually, I mean, in the U.S.
However, says the Wall Street Journal. Sorry, Stacey, let me just finish this one.
Go ahead.
Google's appeal, however, won't stop the company from having to pay its fine or comply with other elements of the June ruling, which could, if upheld, have far-reaching impacts on Google's increasingly sprawling business.
Okay, so they do have to pay it now.
Okay. Which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
That is. Usually in the U.S., if you appeal something, you stop the clock on it being implemented.
If they pay and it's overturned, do they get a refund?
With interest?
Good question.
Store credit.
I want my $5 billion
back. Bitcoin.
All right. And then there's this Bloomberg opinion piece by Alex Webb that you were talking about, Stacey. Google, it's not quite the same what's going on with Google and Microsoft. We discussed this quite a bit in during Windows Weekly. Mm-hmm. And I knew that this panel would probably be pro Google. And
there was a little bit of Microsoft fan Schadenfreude there.
You know, I would never accuse Paul of that. In fact, he used to dislike Google, and he even said today, you know, that's the old Paul.
Yeah.
He did point out that Google's market share does give you cause for concern how they may leverage that, and I certainly don't think now that you've given it a justification, Jeff. Maybe I'll change my tune on that notion of forcing handset makers to choose. You know, either you're a Google platform or you're not. You still can
imagine the confusion, Leo. You go buy a Samsung phone, or you don't know if it's
what
a good Android or a bad Android.
Yeah.
It's
and
brand
we talked
protection.
About that a little bit last week because we talked about the security implications, of having the Google Store, the Play Store, on your device, and the sort of protections they've built into that.
That's a very good point. It's a Wild West if you're not using the Google Play Store.
Well, it occurs to me Amazon. Couldn't have put out a pure Google phone when they did the miserable Fire phone.
Well, they could have,
but they were already putting out a bad version of Android as a company.
Oh, I see.
When they tried to do a phone,
They
probably wouldn't have been allowed. Not that they would have, but they wouldn't have been allowed to do a good Android phone.
And then what about this other accusation that Google charges different amounts of money to different companies? That they favor some companies, they give them sweetheart deals. On Android.
Well, are they charging them different amounts of money, or are they having the same kind of value associated with things in doing different pricing? I mean, it's one thing for me to say, hey, Leo, because you're having me on the show, I'll give you a discount on my time appearing on the show because there's a benefit to me, right? So they could have that because your market share is huge and you're promulgating the Android name in India, we're going to charge you less.
Yeah, that seems like a reasonable business.
That's what
media companies do it all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Friends and family.
Yeah, all kinds of things.
I mean, because they're just going after just Google. Dollars.
Yeah. And it has to also be said, and I'm always surprised by how little the F word comes up, but FairSearch is basically an organization. It's basically Oracle and Microsoft and some other anti-Google companies. And they are driving all this stuff.
They're the ones who bring,
and it's just, I think there should be more criticism for an approach to business that basically says, let's attack them in every way we can. Let's, let's get them in the courts, all that stuff. FairSearch is it's a really annoying organization.
Here's their page, fairsearch.org. And here's the press package on the Google Android decision. I wonder how they feel about it. It'll foster competition. May help restore competition for apps and operating systems. Principles should apply to smart TVs as well as smartphones. Fair Search said a European Commission decision on Wednesday will help restore competition in mobile operating systems and apps vital for the digital economy by requiring Google to end abuses arising from its control of Android. Are they fighting to wrest Android away from Google?
What?
What bothers me about
I don't know.
What bothers me about Fair Search is that there are areas where Microsoft and Oracle compete directly against Google, and they should, you know, be aggressive in all those different ways. But what Fair Search does is they go after every aspect of Google. It's just an anti-Google organization.
It's anti-Google. It's not.
Here's a really perspective I hadn't seen. The Süddeutsche Zeitung, which is one of the big respectable papers in Germany, I just put it on the rundown on the chat. So Europe's billion-dollar penalty against Google is a warning to Trump.
Okay. About?
I think about fair trade and such.
Oh, you think it has to do with the trade war?
Well, what's wrong with that perspective is that this started three years ago.
5 years ago. This has been going on for a while.
Yeah.
So this started in the Obama era. Yeah, I think that's a little stretch.
Yeah,
I think it is, but it's quite for this paper to do that analysis is fascinating.
Tell us about this paper. What's its
the Süddeutsche?
Yeah,
it's the Washington Post of Germany.
Okay,
right. So there's two the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung and the Süddeutsche Zeitung are the daily papers from north and south. And then Die Zeit, I just looked there. Someone looking at the FAZ. Because I'm curious what the reception is in Europe. Any of you speak French? Then it's top story on FAZ.net. It's the top story. We will appeal the commission, the picture of Sundar.
What do they do with $5 billion that they harvest from their Google ATM? Like, do they lower taxes by $5 billion? Do they buy more buildings in Brussels? What do they do with the money?
That's a good question.
And gosh,
they give it to orphans, I think.
Yeah, I don't think so.
No.
They definitely need money for both social services and if you think about migrant challenges, that's probably, but
I'm gonna guess
go into
that's not the plan, that's not where it's
yeah it
go.
Could fund it could fund the regulatory agency, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, what do governments do with fines anyway, right? I mean, it's just, you know,
well, in the U.S. it depends on the body that's cash. Fining. So
meanwhile, the top story at the Mirror is revealed Sam and Georgia, the contestants who shocked Love Island by quitting after controversial recoupling. So it's not taking over all of Europe.
Love Island. Where's that? And how can I get there?
It's a cruise you'll be on.
Right. I'm on the Love Island cruise. Kara Swisher. I love her lead. Yesterday, I motored my Ford Fiesta down to Facebook's headquarters in Menlo Park to interview CEO and founder Mark Zuckerberg.
Does she really drive a Ford Fiesta?
Well, I just find that fascinating. Is that to establish her credentials as a woman of the people? Or
yeah.
It's an odd lead, but she did get quite the story. Zuckerberg defending having Holocaust deniers
platform. This is why he needs to hire smart people like journalists and professors.
He hires journalists. Many of my former colleagues work at Facebook.
Yeah, but they don't work in a position to have policy. And this is just naive, and naive is too nice a word. It's ignorant.
Yeah,
Kara is also really good at her job.
Okay,
even if
she still drives a Ford Fiesta.
Here's the problem with globalization. If you're Facebook and you want to be what Facebook is, the company that owns more users than people exist on the planet, who rakes in all the money and has all the power and is the biggest source of news in history of mankind, et cetera, then you have to be in Middle Eastern countries. You have to be in countries where Holocaust denial is the official.
You think that's why?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's a problem on every topic. There are certain topics where it's like, oh, you can't, as a company, you can't support that position in China. As a company, you can't support that position in these other places. he's got to please everybody. And so it's like if the official line is to crack down on Holocaust denial, you'll actually be cracking down on governments who are using Facebook.
Well, but he also defends Sandy Hook deniers. I don't know what government wants that. Why don't you, Kara asks, want to just say get off our platform? Mark responds, look, as abhorrent as, I guess I could play the audio, but I'll read it. Look, as abhorrent as some of this content could be, I do think it gets down to this principle of giving people a voice. Let me give you an example of where we would take it down. In Myanmar, Sri Lanka, where there's a history of sectarian violence, similar to the tradition in the U.S. where you can't go in a movie theater and yell fire because it creates imminent harm, the principles that we have on what we remove from the service are, if it's going to result in real harm, real physical harm, and by the way, this is the law of the United States as well. You know, you can say anything you want, but as soon as you threaten somebody with physical harm, if they're in fear, that's not protected speech.
Right.
If you're attacking individuals, then that content shouldn't be on the platform. There's a lot of categories that we can get into, but there's a broad debate. So Kara says, okay, Sandy Hook didn't happen. It's not a debate. That's false. You can't just take that down. Mark says, well, I agree it's false. I also think that going to someone who is a victim of Sandy Hook and telling him, hey, no, you're a liar, that is harassment. We will take that down. But he doesn't mention we won't take the Sandy Hook as false. I'm Jewish. There's a set of people who deny that the Holocaust happened. He brought it up. I find that deeply offensive. But at the end of the day, I don't believe our platform should take that down because I think there are things that different people get wrong. I don't think that they're intentionally getting it wrong.
That's the problem. That's what's so far off. Yes, of course a Holocaust denier is getting it intentionally wrong.
Well, and Kara says that. He says, well, it's hard to impugn intent to understand the intent.
Which is him talking about scale, really.
Yeah.
He's talking about the degree of difficulty of the task.
Yeah.
What he's trying, because he's matching two different things here. One is the question of principles. On what principles? So there's a lot of discussion last week, and there was press stories, and I'm sure you probably saw them or maybe already discussed them, about InfoWars. And you have press people saying, why don't you just take InfoWars off of Facebook and off of YouTube? And at an anecdotal level, I agree. But at a principle level, you can't do that until you set the principle that says, what's the ongoing, enforceable, scalable principle that you are proposing for what gets taken down and what does not?
That's well said, Jeff. That's exactly the problem. And it is a sticky problem for sure.
But I agree. But we got to all be in on the stickiness here.
Does this come down to whether they're a publisher or a platform?
Right.
Is it related to that issue?
That is exactly.
In Europe, it does, but.
I mean, it is. Do you want to neutrally host everything, platform, or do you want to exercise judgment? And judgment implies values. It has to.
No, I think you can still have values, and you can be a platform, and you can still make decisions. And so it's a platform
about
doesn't mean you take everything.
Make decisions standards about what types of quality or the types of content, because that is judging.
Yeah. But that's not the definition of publisher. That's not the definition of media to me. And we in media tend to look at the world godlike and keep on thinking it's about us. I had this argument on Twitter today with Christopher Mims from the Wall Street Journal. Well, it's media and that's content. And I said, no, it's neither. It's not media. And for that matter, it is not content. It is conversation. And that is different. And so, you know, I think we keep on trying to put these new pegs into our old holes.
So we've got platform, conversation, and then publisher. Yes?
I'm saying we have old definitions and old concepts of publisher and platform, whether that platform is a phone company or whatever. And I'm saying these things are something new that we don't fully understand.
Conversation. So talk to me then about, okay, so then let's talk about conversation and what the rules of quote unquote conversation are. If you are, because Facebook is not, are you saying Facebook's in on this conversation and part of the conversation because of its role as a platform for hosting it? Not in that old definition, but just because that's the question that I think we should figure out. I
mean, right, so let's turn it into a bar, Stacey. Right, we're a bar, okay? And in a bar, you have the right to refuse service to someone like, oh, I don't know, Sarah Sanders, right? And you can refuse to service for various reasons, right? Facebook has the right to refuse service to people. Google has the right. Twitter has the right to just say, we don't like this for whatever reason they have. Same reason that a bar and now in this country, a baker can refuse service.
Does that make them less of a platform and more of a publisher?
No,
that's what I'm saying. It makes them a conversation place.
It makes them something new and different, Leo. And that's the issue. We keep on trying to find the analogs to a world of 50 and 100 years ago. And this is something new and we don't appreciate it. We in media keep on trying to define things in our image as if we're God.
So let's
want to be us.
So let me confuse things further. So we're talking about whether they throw InfoWars off or don't throw InfoWars off. Their solution, air quotes, is they're going to sort of deprioritize.
Downrank them.
Yeah, so what's the deal with that? So they can just like...
So let me go into that, Mike, and let me first do a caveat, do a disclosure. Important for every show where this comes up is that I raised money from Facebook, Craig Newmark, Ford Foundation, and others to work on these issues at News Integrity Initiative. And I haven't announced anything yet, but I'm also going to be doing a new project here where, Mike, I'm going to work on exactly that question. So let me just give a second's background on this. What I learned from Facebook, and we have a group of people, product development people in the news business we had in, and we had a Facebook person in about a year ago. And we asked that person, what's news at Facebook? How do you define news? And it was fascinating because the definition came back, there's social content and there's public content, period. And public content was one big bucket that included everything that wasn't created on Facebook or wasn't social. So the New York Times and the Washington Post and Vladimir's Lying Blog were all in the same bucket, and Facebook had no concept, no variation of definition or of quality in all of that. So when Vlad got him in trouble, that's when they downranked and pushed off basically all public content. So now what they're saying is we're going to bring back to prominence quality content, quality news content. But they don't really know what news is, and they don't really know what quality is. And so I'm working on a project, not just for Facebook, but for Google, Twitter, ad agencies, and so on, to try to aggregate the signals of quality and lack thereof so that they can make more informed decisions. And we do have the platforms just choosing to make decisions. Google has said they account for the reliability, authority, and quality of sources in search. Twitter is accounting for the quality of the public conversation. Facebook is now accounting for the quality of news sources. But they don't know how to do it. And they don't know what's there, and we've got to help them. So, Mike, back to the question. There's basically three things that Facebook can do, four things. One is that they can kick you off. You are abhorrent, and we kick you off. And there are some things that meet that test, but very few. They can downrank. That is to say that they don't promote it. If Leo shares it with you, you'll probably see it, but your friends won't see it. Number three, they can forbid you to get monetization, either by receiving ad revenue or by placing ads. And then four, right? Kick you off, downrank you. Oh, and then four is they can put up notices to the user that give indication about this site. Hey, all of our fact checkers said this is bunk. You want to look at it, okay, but watch out, it's bunk. So those are the tools that they have at hand.
Then the question becomes, this is a lovely, those are good distinctions, but then you're not really describing a bar nor a conversation because of the power imbalance. And
True.
So I feel like we still either A, don't have the right vocabulary, or they still look a lot like a publisher.
And the thing
I think we don't have the right vocabulary, Stacey. I think the fact that you're open to that idea is key here. That's why we have to try to, using the old analogies doesn't really work, and bar doesn't work either, I grant.
Well, so because the big challenge here is Facebook is, their goal isn't to be a bar because no bar wants to be, or no current conversational hub aims to be the place for every single conversation in the way that Facebook, it's their goal. And it's their goal, you know, because they're actually creating a marketplace for users to like find and advertise to people, right? That's their actual goal. So we've got to break that down because you can't be a home for conversation, but then trying to sell that conversation. That's kind of like trying to say,
who says you can't? It's just a new model. Under what rule? Show me the rule that says you can't do that.
It feels icky. Which is not a new, which is not
that kind of is a bar actually, right? That literally is a bar.
Yeah, because they're selling the booze.
The difference is that imagine if Mark Zuckerberg actually did own a bar, he would, and he ran it like Facebook.
What a
he would
fun be place that'd be.
Who gets to sit with whom? Who gets to say what? Who gets to hear what? He would control literally everything. This is the thing that bothered me.
Not only that, he would also control the ability for people who want to sell different types of cocktails to people access to that cocktail restaurant.
I think let's not overstretch the bar analogy. Yes. Obviously, it's snap.
Well, let's have a drink. Why don't you pop open that bottle of wine?
But I think it's not unreasonable to say, well, maybe there is this something besides publisher and platform that Facebook is. And I think if Mark says, we have a rule, the rule is as long as you don't promote harm to another person, even if what you say is false, we're going to allow it.
But that's BS, because here's the thing that we should be talking about. Facebook wants to control what your relationships are, who hears what. I mean, Jeff says that, okay, InfoWars, he gave the example that if you were deprioritized and you posted something, maybe I would see it, but nobody else would see it. That's not exactly how it works. Even the most innocuous thing only goes to like 10 or 12 or 13%. Who knows? Nobody knows. Nobody knows who sees what in the news feeds.
And one of the reasons Mark's making this PR tour, he also did some interviews with CNN and other
journalists, again,
is because Sandy Hook's parents are suing Alex Jones of InfoWars, and this is also bled into the Facebook presence because both are on Facebook for lying. So there is harm if somebody in a conversation on Facebook says, "Oh, Sandy Hook never happened." Those people who say their kids were shot are actors. And they're pursuing a political agenda. Well, that seems to me harmful if it's not true.
But again, the thing that the reason we have to have these complicated conversations is because Facebook, we're accepting that Facebook must be in control of everything. Where we should be arguing for is a more Twitter-like thing where the user is in control. There's all kinds of really objectionable things on Twitter.
You can do that, Mike. You can do that right now, and it's a crappy user experience.
Yeah, we should be pushing them to make it a good user experience. If you go there and say,
look, that they are. They are by trying to find the things that you like and prioritize that. That's exactly what they're doing.
But the community, there should be no community guidelines. Anything should go on Facebook if you want anything. And if you say, oh, I don't want to hear about Holocaust denial, and I don't want to hear Alex Jones fake news.
Let's do something a little less loaded. Breastfeeding pictures.
Why? Exactly.
Now they don't anymore, right? I think they allow that now
through public pressure.
They do, but it took a long time.
So what's the harm? Where is the harm there?
Jonathan Zittrain of Harvard has argued to Facebook, and I've been in the room when he's argued this, that basically we should all get some dials.
Yeah,
and that if we want to watch nothing but Alex Jones, then make that my choice and my responsibility.
I agree with that.
Right? I see the point and I get it. And that's going more to the full platform side. But I also see that look at all the pressure Facebook's under. There are things that occur on its brand that they either host or promote that have an impact. And I think they have a right to say, as a publisher does, if you want to go to the publisher end, whether or not to have that. The kind of pressure they're under is just they can't win, which is where it goes. So if you go, Leo, the Congress on Facebook and the net, it's a Twitter thread about Facebook. It shows you the kind – so when – the other reason I think Zuckerberg's out there is because they had testimony before Congress once again. And the kind of pressure on them is ridiculous from each end. So you have – one member of Congress saying, I mean, you have the diamond and silk and diamond silk, right? So you have Steve King going, why doesn't the Gateway pundit get more traffic? You should be giving them more traffic. This is bad that you don't give them more traffic, right? And then they say, then Lamar Smith accuses Google of blocking all searches for Jesus, Chick-fil-A, and the Catholic religion. and then you have Ted Deutch say, why is Alex Jones and InfoWars on YouTube at all? And then you have Ted Poe, representative, denounces Snoops, a left-wing organization, right? So what they're trying to say is, F you all, right? And Leo's right. I think we're going to put a standard. I don't like where the standard is myself, personally. The standard is going to be, as you said, Leo, if you're trying to harm people, then we'll take that down.
But there's a big issue because I think it is harmful to people to say your kid wasn't shot.
Right. So define harm is the issue. Exactly.
That's a hard thing to define.
And I think InfoWars harms democracy. And I think that you can't be neutral anymore and you have to make some decisions here.
But you would support one person saying such horrible things in a barbershop in some small town to another person.
They have the right to do that.
If I were the barber, I had someone in my office.
Yeah,
I had someone in my office this week.
So how about on the street?
Things that I found rather abhorrent, about Israel and Palestine.
Yeah.
And I didn't kick that person out, but I said, I'm not going to choose to deal with that person. That's my right. That's my choice.
But again,
right?
I have zero sympathy for the pressure Facebook is under. They don't have to make $40 billion a year. There's nobody says, why are we all cheering for them to be just the most dominant, powerful thing in the history of mankind? They should give up control, and we users should be demanding control and stop twisting ourselves in knots trying to make sure that Facebook has all the money, all the control, and all the users.
How would that
work? Why are we working too much time?
The only control I can assert, which I have asserted, is to leave Facebook. Right. Is there an intermediate where I could stay on Facebook and have more control? You want it to be more like Google Plus?
You can turn things off. You can unfollow people. You can unhide all. They have all these controls. But what you can't do is say, yeah, I want to see things that violate the community standards. Why are there community standards? And whose community is this?
Because,
I have my own community.
Mike, whoa. Why are there community standards? Because we're screaming about how we're living in a horrible, uncivil world right now, and there is some level of responsibility that these platforms have,
Because Facebook's algorithm, which controls everything, is designed to make people glued and addicted to their screens.
They have said, for example, that yes, you should be more of that. We would get you to watch dumb cat videos, and now they say we are going to instead emphasize meaningful interactions between people. So they've changed that as a strategy. And don't forget, Mike, that media's model is exactly what you just described.
Yeah.
Media invented that model. Media created clickbait. Media wanted to glue you to everything. Media wants to addict you. So it ain't just Facebook, folks. It's our business, too.
Part of the problem is that Facebook wants to be the internet. We would all agree that there's nobody running the internet saying, take that down, put that up.
Yeah.
And I think some of this problem is that Facebook wants to become your internet. And for many people, it is. I had a caller on the radio show who told me that she got all of her news from Facebook.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you have to stop doing that. And I suggested some alternate sources. But for many people, Facebook is their internet. So is that
especially
the issue? I mean, we wouldn't say, hey, Mr. If there was somebody.
There is an issue of confusing public content with personal content in some ways. And we do this in the real world, not just in the fake world, on the internet. So we call our Aunt Susie, and some of us are like, you know, there are people in my family who will take anecdotal evidence from their friends as being far superior to actual
fact-based
proof and facts. So I had someone explain to me why baldness actually was transmitted over the father side. If your father is bald, you're going to be bald. And I tried to explain how these genes work. So I think there's...
That gets you evolution, Stacey. You're probably going to lose that too.
I did. I lost that. I actually lost that battle. And, I was like, okay, that's cool. That's fine.
But that's a fairly harmless mistake.
It is. So that's the thing.
But it's an example.
I think it's silly that Facebook's trying to make this distinction. I think it serves its own ends in a way that's probably not helpful, because given the scale, and there was actually a really good article in Wired a couple weeks ago. It's called The Complexity of Simply Searching for Medical Advice.
Was so good. Yes.
Yeah. In it, they talk about this data void, and they bring up an example on Facebook of people searching for vitamin K shots for their newborns.
Right.
And if you search for that on Facebook, so basically if you're calling your friends and family, like you might do, to say, hey, they want me to do this. Did you guys do this? What they got was a lot of information from anti-vaxxers. And yes, somebody didn't get their shot and somebody's baby died. And that is a tragedy that did not have to happen. And so that's an example where, you know, did Facebook cause this harm? Wired calls it the data void. Oh, no, sorry. Bing calls it the data void. Wired talks about the asymmetry of passion here. So,
yes, doctors who are fact-based aren't doing a lot of posts on the value of vitamin K for infants, but people who think it's killing their infants are posting a lot.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunately, gives a higher weight on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Which is a larger problem in society as well of trusting science. That's the problem with Stacey's conversation, is the person she was talking to wouldn't trust science.
I don't think that's actually the issue. Yes, that is a issue, but I think the big issue is these companies make it really easy to find things that someone really cares about promoting. So there is Alex Jones doesn't just put his crazy ideas out there. He actively promotes them in a variety of different ways. Whereas the rest of us are like, A, ignoring it because it's crazy to think that Sandy Hook never happened. Why would we ever think that? Or B, there's only 20 parents who are really passionate about, you know, trying to change this and promote it. And they're kind of hobbled because they're like by the ideals of common decency. And that's I think, a bigger issue that all of these things happen. And that's something that Facebook isn't talking about, nor is Google. Okay.
That's so what do you, in a way, Stacey, what you were saying, Stacey, what do you suggest? What is the solution then to that? What's the principle you propose?
Is to start realizing. So I think it's a bigger solution across all of technology, especially as we move into AI. It's this idea of understanding adversaries. So understanding who wants to promote different ideas, understanding that there are going to be two or multiple sides to anything, and some of them are not wrong, which means you do have to say the Holocaust didn't happen, right? Or sorry, that the Holocaust happened.
Did happen,
Trump-like reversal.
Because it did happen.
Which Google, Stacey, has made that decision, right? So Google says you should be able to find the Holocaust denier because they're out there. But if you ask, is the Holocaust real? The answer is yes. And as I've talked about in the show in the past, if you now ask, is climate change real? You're going to get science back, not conspiracy theories first. So Google's made that decision. I asked them directly. This means you're siding with science? And they said yes.
I think Facebook actually has to do that in times where in cases where there is actual, like, we know Sandy Hook happened. There's no freaking doubt about that. And Facebook should have some sort of disclaimer at night or shouldn't show it at all. I mean,
so Stacey, here's your let me probe that for a second. So this is where we're getting to the difference, though, in your view of publisher and platform, blah, 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 blah. A key difference here in what we just talked about is that Google deals with information, whereas Facebook deals with people. And
but
that's what makes Facebook so complicated.
There's another distinction. Google search doesn't filter, it ranks. And Facebook
that's
filters.
Exactly what Facebook does. Facebook ranks. It's all there, Mike. If you kept going all day, you would see it all. It is ranked.
I've tried. I can't see it all. I go to the Facebook news feed and I go through and I see these, you know, from like five people. And then I go the next day and it's the same post I saw yesterday.
You keep going and going and going and going and going, this is what they've said. I've been in rooms with people. Okay. People have been asked.
Yeah.
They are ranking, and then if you kept clicking next,
yeah,
you would eventually see it all, or you can go to the feed where you see it all.
The other difference is that you can't
ranking.
You can't search Facebook for content and get
they have a
results.
Rapid search on Earth.
It's deliberate. It's obviously deliberate. They don't want people searching Facebook on Google. Theoretically, you search for some question, you see the.
Wait a minute. Facebook doesn't want you to search?
No.
Why not?
It's not. Because that's a way to actually use Facebook in a way that isn't mediated by Facebook.
Well, but say Facebook isn't a search engine, though, Mike. It's different, and I think I would get
pretty crappy results. But they do have a search box.
Yeah, but if I search for information on Facebook, it'd be awful.
But shouldn't we demand that if Facebook is supposed to be a source of information, instead we're supposed to be just spoon-fed. But
wait a minute. Who says it's supposed to be a source of information?
People get information from Facebook. People get more information.
That's one of the things.
More people get information from Facebook than any newspaper, any news publication, et cetera. Let me finish the point. If a news feed spoon feeds you stuff, it's like here's a crazy conspiracy theory.
It's like a
by
media
itself.
Company.
Whereas searching for something, if I were to say, well, is that true? And I should be able to search Facebook and see all the perspectives that are on Facebook. But why aren't we upset that they deliberately prevent you from searching? They have a search bar. They make you think there's a search function. Twitter has a search function. Google Plus has a perfect search. Every place has a search except Facebook deliberately hobbles search. Why aren't we upset about that?
Because it's not a content site, and I think what you would get back in search, I'm too frustrated by the search, but when I'm looking for a person, it's crappy
but
search, right? I should be able to find that.
Why are they taking that agency away from us?
It's the world's biggest source agency. Of content. I think you're presuming it's something different than it's not. You're trying to make Facebook into Google, and it's not.
Let's say
I think that Mike's right because I think Facebook wants to be the internet. It doesn't want you to use Google. You can't link out of Facebook.
That's a good point.
You have to live in Facebook, and that's Facebook's goal. I mean, this is to your point also of them making $50 billion a year. They want to be the internet.
Right.
So I think if you're going to make that your goal, then it would behoove you to do some of the things that the internet does or Google does, because for many people, Google's the internet.
Right. So let's say you run a podcast network. Say, for example, just grab.
Let's just say
anybody would want to do that, but go ahead.
Yeah, you're going to get ads for mental illness and all that stuff. But yeah, sure. So somebody has a podcast network, and let's say you want to find podcast enthusiasts. Right. You go to Twitter. You search for podcast fan.
That's easy.
Get all these people. Google Plus, Google Search. You can go anywhere and find that.
You can't do that on Facebook?
No way. They are not really? Going to. No, you want to find the podcast fans, you better pay the advertising money, and they'll tell you exactly.
Oh, that's why.
They'll tell you exactly who the podcast fans are.
Can you search for subject material?
You can search for anything if you pay for an ad and you do.
But the I can't go to Facebook and search for Sandy Hook.
You won't get anything usable at all. I mean,
and you think that that's because they want you to pay for that capability.
They want to control exactly what you know, what you see, who you connect with. They want to control it all because that's where the money is. That's right. What I'm saying.
So that is directly in opposition to the other thing they want, which is to be the single and sole source of information.
They want it both ways.
You can't get both.
What they really want is for you to spend as much time as possible on Facebook. They want you to spend as much money as possible on Facebook.
And they want you to look at what they tell you to look at.
Exactly. And they want to know everything.
Is that not fair, Jeff? That sounds like a fair characterization of Facebook.
I think Leo, your characterization before was better. It's about going outside of Facebook. I disagree with Mike's characterization that Facebook's goal is to be a source of information. Facebook's goal is to be a place for conversation, which is my discussion with Stacey, and that changes.
I think that's their stated goal. I think their larger goal is that you never leave Facebook.
Yeah.
Period.
Oh, that's for sure.
Leo, I'm agreeing with that. But I'm not agreeing with the point that Mike is making, that the basis of what they do is to be a source of information.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's the basis of what they do, but I'm saying that in reality, they are the second largest source of information, besides Google Search.
They are the source of information. Here, I'm just going to take issue a little bit with you, Mike, here, only because I just did it. Yeah. So I went on Facebook and I searched for Sandy Hook, and I got links to a variety of Facebook pages. One is an anti-gun effort. One is the town itself. And then now related searches, the top one is Sandy Hook's hoax. The second one is Sandy Hook's summer concerts. The third, and this is just related, Sandy Hook was a hoax. And then Sandy Hook National Park, Sandy Hook Beach.
Wow.
So scrolling down, I see posts from friends.
I'm not seeing any of that.
So, yeah, and that's part of the customization. Most of my friends believe that Most of my friends know Sandy Hook happened. So they're very like, hey, gun violence is bad, blah, blah, blah. The public posts are CNN, something about park rangers at Sandy Hook, and another CNN story about Sandy Hook victims filing a lawsuit against Alex Jones. And then on the articles front, again, Mark Zuckerberg does not want to ban Holocaust deniers or Sandy Hook truthers. So I don't actually see anything except for the related searches about Sandy Hook being a hoax.
I don't either. Yeah, you're getting the word Sandy Hook in page titles and in hashtags, but probably
not in the content of posts. I'm getting my friends' statements too. I'm getting journalists talking about disagreeing with what Zuckerberg said. And decrying Alex Jones.
I'm just going to say, I love it that I can't play this game. I'm not getting anything because I can't go on Facebook.
And if I go to, and this is an interesting thing, I think, if I Google just Sandy Hook, a couple stories down, I actually get the Sandy Hook hoax by NYMag, right? And that's actually not talking about it being a hoax. It's talking about the people who think it was a hoax. But then a couple stories down after that, I get the Sandy Hook hoax theories explained from HuffPo. And what's happening is the news coverage of these hoaxers are driving up that concept in these searches. So then what I'm doing is it's actually taking these marginalized, weird views of people and saying, and making them somewhat legit, because I could click on that. And some people are going to read that and be like, ooh, I never thought about that. What if that's actually true? Holy cow. especially people who are inclined to believe more of these things, because they're promoting this as, and they're not really promoting it as two opposing viewpoints, two legitimate opposing viewpoints, but that's what some people are going to look at it as.
I think so, it's not surprising that if you were going to design Facebook, that maybe you wouldn't explicitly you would say what Zuckerberg says. It's about connecting all the people in the world, blah, blah, blah. But what you would end up with is something that is designed to be as sticky as possible, to keep people inside of Facebook looking at the news feed, because that's where you could most reasonably monetize them.
Yeah.
I understand why search wouldn't be that good. You really do, and I never used search in Facebook. Mm-hmm. I remember they promoted it for a while to find things,
It
would never really worked well. And of course, there's
can't
no
find
incentive.
People.
Yeah, there's not really.
I want to find people. I can't find
there's
people.
There's not much of an incentive for them to do that. Really, I don't think this was even necessarily a conscious decision. But if you want to be maximize the profitability and the success of a company of Facebook, you would say, don't leave Facebook. Have that be your only page. That's your internet. Have the news feed be the thing that feeds you, because that way we can feed you the most appropriate advertising. We'll monitor what you click on, what you read, what you spend time on, so as to maximize that time spent. It's a feedback loop that seems to work. That whether you say we're about connecting the world's people or whatever, that's what you would end up with, right?
And despite all my complaining about Facebook and
does it very well.
Google, it does it very well. And I think we'll look back at this as kind of a golden era, because we're facing some real problems in the future. The first problem we're facing is, you notice when Facebook was facing the Senate hearings and all that kind of stuff, ultimately, the only real solutions he provided it was, oh, we're going to have AI take care of all of that. Yeah, AI will take it. So that's all secret behind the scenes. We're not going to see AI.
Right.
Choosing
it's just
what's
magic.
Fake news.
It's
and
basically
what
magic
right.
hand waving.
It's going to put it under the rug, and nobody will have access to what is being censored. The other problem with Google and Siri and virtual assistants is, in the future, if I ask Siri or Google Assistant a question, it's going to give me an answer. I'm not going to get 100,000 results ranked. I'm going to get the answer.
Same problem.
It's a bigger problem, because it's like, wow, so
somebody
these
has
companies
to decide
are
what the
deciding
answer is.
What the truth is,
yeah.
which is really a problem, and I don't know how we're going to solve it.
And you forgot a third problem, Mike, which is AI is still really bad at interpreting and applying human common sense to inquiries and questions.
Yeah.
I love how far we've come, but there is a reason that, you know, AI is still laughably bad at a lot of interpretive spots. So before we get all freaked out about it, we actually have to make it decent. So
I think this would be a good time to have a glass of wine.
Yeah,
by the way, I have a solution that we can all
perfect. Like, I need a drink for
I
this.
Gave you the perfect segue by doing the bar thing.
Yeah, right.
And you ignored it, Leo. I'm
was that why you
me.
Did that?
That's
I thought it was
it.
Because, remember we played this thing, was it from Conan or one of the late night shows, if Facebook were a bar? Remember, that video?
Oh, I never saw that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, while I'm talking
about... I think someone
said it was SNL. It was SNL. And it was exactly what Facebook would be like if it were a bar. For the bartender pushing, of course,
right.
All of these theories that keep people in there, because they don't want anybody to leave. I don't think, Mark, I would... After reading... kudos to Kara Swisher. Good interview. She challenged him. She did as good a job as you can with a CEO.
She wears sunglasses indoors, but she's a great interviewer.
Yeah, I think she did a very good job. And I think I would say, based on that interview, which is at recode.com, Mark is not an evil or malicious person. Although if he, understand that one of the reasonable questions people might have is he?
I think he's evil.
Does he have an agenda? Because if he did, he has the perfect evil genius power.
Yeah.
To promote whatever that agenda might be.
No. He is evil. He is evil because he doesn't understand his own privilege. No, he doesn't want to understand, and he doesn't.
People are privileged rarely understand.
Stacey, we're seeing that you're in a time where we're seeing a lot of evil. You're devaluing the term.
There's eviler.
It's not evil, but I think it's irresponsible.
He might
think it's irresponsible.
That's a big difference, Stacey. A huge difference.
I think it's reprehensible.
There's got to be a good use for algorithms and personal choice. How about there, Leo?
Choosing a wine you will.
Here we go.
So that's the segue I was looking for. We're going to talk about Wink. Wink is awesome. And I'm going to open. We just got our new Wink box. If you go to trywink, trywinc.com/twig, you could take the Wink taste profile test. It's kind of fun. Do you like salt on your food? Do you like coffee? How do you like your coffee? Do you like peppers? Do you like citrus? Anyway, take the test, and then Wink is going to recommend some wines. Wink is a winemaker, okay? So what that means is they find great wines that they make from great grapes all over the world. You choose how many reds, how many whites. We, in our family, Lisa, will not drink white wine. I don't know why. I love white wine, but you know that about us, Mike, because you always bring us red.
Yep.
So we did this. You do the profile. You subscribe. Every month you're going to get, you can get more if you want, but the typical subscription is a bottle a week, four bottles. Yeah. Maybe two you have with a meal, one you put in your cellar for later, one you bring to friends when you go over. There's nothing nicer, by the way, than bringing a bottle of Wink wine to friends because they have beautiful labels. They're wines that are delicious. They're very drinkable. And it's so fun every month. When we just got our box today. When we get our box, we get a little Let There Be Wine delivered to your doorstep. There's the envelope describing the wines. Lots of background information. And let's see what we got this week in our Wink box. Oh, boy. I'm going to put this down. Let's start with, just at random. Now, that's a good label. Baseline. Baseline, it is from Santa Barbara, La Encantada Vineyard. It's a 2016 Pinot. Pick with conviction. That sounds delicious.
Picked by convicts?
Picked by convicts. No. Okay. They do have some wines. The field theory, there's a field theory with a Austrian varietal that they pick in the middle of the night because they want the grapes to be cool. Here's Rogue Admirals, a Shiraz from Australia. I'm a fan of Australian Shirazes, aren't you?
Leo, only Australians say Shiraz. It's Syrah.
It's a Syrah.
California, yes.
But if you're down under, it's a Shiraz, mate.
Okay.
From the limestone coast, product of Australia, dubbed the shipwreck coast after many a vessel failed to navigate its savage shores, South Australia's limestone coastline has always been a fearful yet fertile land. So, wow, I can't wait to try that. Yeah. I like Shiraz.
Me too.
And I like Shirazes.
Well, actually, Shiraz is the original name. The Francification name is Syrah. So it's originally from, like, Lebanon or Syria.
Oh, I didn't
know
that.
Yeah, yeah. It's
Mike
a,
is an expert.
Yeah, it's from the Levant or whatever you call
Lisa
it.
Lisa loves Pinot, so we got two bottles of that baseline. We'll put one down and we'll have one for dinner probably tonight.
Baselines.
Ooh, look at this. Vin Dieu. She's also a big fan of French wines, and but remember, this is a Beaujolais from Beaujolais Latinier, which is a particular appellation. It's a protected appellation, which means this is going to be pretty special. Vin Dieu, what does that mean? 20 gods?
Beaujolais? 30.
30. No, no, 20 is vin.
Vin Dieu. Oh, 22.
Vin Dieu. No, it's not Dieu, it's Dieu.
Ah.
It's 20 gods. I don't know what that means, but we'll find out. They do great labels, which make it a really wonderful housewarming gift. Wines start at just $13 a bottle. Shipping is included. They go right to your door. If you take the palate profile quiz, that'll get you started. But as you every month goes by, you pick new delicious wines. This summer, of course, you've got to try the insanely popular Summer Water Rosé. That is amazing. And actually, you could try Paul Thurrott's trip. He likes to turn rosé into slushies. He freezes them in slushies.
Oh, jeez. No, rosés.
Well, I was at Cannes Lions, and they had rosé slushies. It's the greatest thing ever.
That's so
unbelievable.
Take a little some. Yeah. Take a rosé and make a slushie out of it.
Yeah.
No water. Don't put water. Or don't put ice in it.
Heavens.
No.
It's strawberry puree in a lot of them.
Oh, well, you could do that, I guess, if you were crazy.
I'm just throwing that out there.
Shipping is covered. If you ever don't like a bottle, don't worry. You don't have to send it back. They'll just send you another one. No questions asked. So sit back, relax, celebrate, enjoy the summer. You'll enjoy the winter just as much. Why settle for the same bottle of wine you always get? We all get wine ruts. I was in a big wine rut. And then along comes Wink.
Well, you go to the store and you face the wall of wine and you're just
overwhelming.
You don't know what's going on. Yeah. And so you get the thing, you know.
I like getting a different wine every time. That's the beauty of wine is it's this variety of flavors.
They have a summer food. Oh, you can get some blender stuff. There's some other stuff in here. This is great. There's a little coupon going in here. I like it. Trywink, TRYWINC.com/twig. Oh, did I mention $20 off your first shipment? Trywink.com/twig. Trywink.com/twig. We're going to have some wine. Should we get wine glasses? Would you like some?
This one has a screw cap.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, it's up to the winemaker, I guess. Yeah.
There are good reasons for screw caps.
If y'all get wine, I'm going to have wine brought to me. So.
Yeah. Okay. Which one should we open?
You got two baselines here.
That's probably why, huh?
That's right.
She knew Mike Elgin would be in house.
That's right.
A little Santa Barbara Pinot.
That's right.
All right.
My hometown.
All right. Is it?
Santa Barbara, yeah.
Oh, I guess I knew that. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
The other wine country.
Colleen is here.
Did you want glasses?
We need glasses and a corkscrew. Isn't it nice to be the king?
It's nice to be in studio. Sorry, guys.
I am sad that I cannot try the wink wine, but I will be imbibing. After that Facebook conversation.
I know, that was...
You're on kind of vacation.
Yeah.
I am on vacation. I'm on as vacation-y as I get.
That's nice. Well, you'll still write while you're there, right?
Oh, I am writing. The newsletter will still go out. Kevin and I recorded a show this morning.
See, this is why having a podcast is cool, because you can do it anywhere. Internet's cool.
I like the internet.
Leo, I was going to go into mock horror at the personalization of the wine taste thing. Oh my God, they know what you like.
Yes, they know what you like.
Oh no.
Giving us what we want.
Won't be allowed in Europe.
Dispatch from Super Internet, says Mike Elgin in Computer World.
Yes.
There is a much better internet than the one you're using. Wait a minute, what?
So, Jeff and I were arguing before the show started about who is the bigger fanboy of the Pixelbook. And he tried to pull the old, I've been a fan longer than you have, therefore I'm a bigger fan. So
We all had the CR48 probably. The original.
But who's been using them exclusively? Exclusively.
Hey, I've been using this exclusively for 2.5 months. How about that? So
iPad-y for a while.
I was and MacBook Pro-y.
Late to the party, Elgin.
I took my MacBook Pro, perfectly good, it's 2015, which is the last good one, and I just tossed it aside, and I've been using this full time. So here's the benefit that nobody talks about. Everybody talks about security and convenience and the fact that it's in the cloud, and nowadays with Android support, it's great. And I've made the point in a column that now the Chromebook platform, the Pixelbook platform, has gone from being the platform that runs the least number of apps to the platform that runs more apps than any platform in history.
Absolutely. So you've got Chrome extensions, you've got Android, and now I'm really excited about Crostini. I can run my Linux.
There
apps.
Are two ways to run Linux. You can run it through the. Well, anyway,
that and make sure it's not. I'm sure it's not, but. This is the tradition of wine, right? You have to open it up, taste it.
Wow, that's fantastic.
All right, baby.
And believe me, even though it's an advertiser.
I'm going to give you a Lisa pour.
Fantastic. So here's the benefit.
Stacey, just 1 second. Like, instead of your boxing glove, I now want a straw.
Yeah, there you go.
There we go.
There you go.
Nice color. So here's the benefit that nobody talks enough about. So Chrome is great. Chrome extensions are great. The problem with Chrome is just clobbers your performance.
Oh,
isn't that? It's a big bold thing. It's like
it's delicious. Yeah.
It clobbers your performance. And now with the new addition of isolating each process within Chrome, the performance is even worse in Chrome.
10%.
Yeah.
But it's more safe.
It's more safe, and the security is fantastic. But with a Pixelbook, and whether it's the 8 gig or the 16 gig Pixelbook, you are. What people don't realize is you are free from those problems. I open 60 tabs at once without any significant performance.
But I don't understand. What is it that makes a Chromebook?
Stacey's got a headache for you.
I run 50, 60, 70 simultaneous extensions.
So I don't understand. And the extensions, what is it doing that's so... it's just Linux, right?
It's a high-powered laptop running a low, low, low-powered operating system.
Oh, you're saying the Pixelbook is the key.
The Pixelbook is the key. Yeah. So in my version of the internet...
By the way, they had a pretty good deal on Pixelbooks Amazon Prime Day.
$7.50 off.
Yeah.
In my version of the internet, the internet that I use, I don't use passwords. I don't have tracking. Every time I put in a password, where that has been compromised and is posted on Black Web, it says, oh, they don't use that password anymore. That's out there.
Chrome does that.
Chrome extensions do that.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so the point is, it's in a subtle point, and I think it's a very important point. Anyone who runs Chrome on Safari, Windows, whatever, can use any of the extensions. But only Pixelbook users can run all the extensions. And when you run all the extensions, for example, I have probably 20 extensions that affect Gmail.
Wow.
I can send SMS. I can send mail merge.
Have you published anywhere your list of recommended extensions?
I really should do that. Yeah. I think it's a really powerful thing. But literally Pixelbook, and pretty soon about 15 or 20 Chromebooks will be powerful enough to run all this stuff. But when you
make an excellent point, which is that basically a hardware designer, manufacturer, Apple, Microsoft, whoever, optimizes the OS for the tasks they expect to be done.
Right.
So the iPad is optimized for certain things, the iPhone. You're saying that the Pixelbook is optimized. Actually, Chrome OS is optimized for lower power CPUs.
It's optimized for the internet, not apps, not all the stuff. Just the internet. Mm-hmm. So I've been using computers since the 80s. And every computer I've ever had, no matter how much I've spent, it's always like, it's too slow. I want it fast. I'm a speed freak, right? Yeah. It's always too slow. This is the first device I've ever had where I don't say that. It's fast.
Yes.
Fast, fast, fast. I mean, it's like so fast.
Did you get the base model?
No, I got the Cadillac. I got the most expensive version of the least expensive computing platform there is. It's basically 2K when I was done with the case and the this and that. Wow.
But that's what you'd spend for a regular laptop.
Yeah.
And if that's optimized for what you do, that's the one to get.
That's right. And just here's an example. So I run an extension that takes away all the tracking. It improves the speed by 43%.
No. Which one is it? Ghostery or?
It's one of those. Let's see. I got it right here in my files.
I want a list of all your extensions because I agree with you.
Send it to Kevin for his About Chromebooks.
Yes. Oh yeah, Kevin, you should talk to
it's
Kevin.
Called Disconnect. It's called Disconnect.
Disconnect.
And that'll Disconnect will also run on your Android phone and your iOS phone, your iPhone. So anyway, the point is that if you're free to go and run many, many, many extensions, and when you do the right extensions, you're in another world. You're in a better internet. All the complaints people have of the internet. There's too much tracking. There's too much ads, there's passwords, blah, blah, blah. You can get rid of every complaint you have about the internet all at the same time if you run enough extensions.
I'm thinking I should buy an upgraded Chromebook.
I was confused about your column, Mike. I read it and I was like, tell me more about this supposed super internet. And I think it's because I was looking for a macro theme that would affect everything. But what you're really just talking about is this optimization around Chrome and the Pixelbook and what Google's doing for Fuchsia.
Well, I don't know. Fuchsia is not part of
the
argument.
The internet and how it operates.
Yeah. So just from my own personal experience, I've been using a MacBook Pro and heavy user of Chrome. And every time I'd add an extension, I'd be like, okay, I got to decommission another extension because it's like, it not just slows down the browser, it slows down everything. It's just really bad. And when I moved to the Pixelbook, I just quadrupled the number of extensions with no performance penalty at all.
Okay, so then you're talking about basically an internet that's customized towards you around extensions, which is your super internet.
But here's the Fuchsia operating system that's optimized for the internet.
Here's the confusing part. So I mentioned Fuchsia in the column, and here's the point I was making. In the future, with Fuchsia and probably other operating systems, I'm talking 10 years from now, you won't have apps that contain features. You'll have features that apply to all the apps. Features will be separated from apps.
That's what I was excited about.
Yes. And that's what extensions do. Extensions take features and they apply it to everything. So, for example,
That's interesting. That's a neat perspective.
Yeah. Okay. So for example, I have this. So websites don't just reveal all the web addresses. On this show, one of my picks of the week a couple months ago was Hunter, which you go to any website and it'll tell you all the web email addresses associated with that website. That's a feature, but it's not a feature of one site. It's a feature of every site. It's a feature that's applied across everything. And this is why Chrome extensions are kind of a glimpse into the future of all operating systems, where features are separated from apps. And this is one of the reasons why the whole internet is transformed if you use enough Chrome extensions. Nobody has any respect for Chrome extensions because it's a problem because of the performance issues. But again, on the Pixelbook and pretty soon a dozen or 20 high-end Chromebooks, we'll be able to run many, many Chrome extensions.
Are there more high-end
they're coming,
Pixelbook
yeah.
equivalents coming?
Yes, yeah. There are many.
$1,649 if you max that out with an i7, a 512 gig hard drive. Do you use the hard drive at all, though? I guess the extensions live there, but documents don't. Right?
I have like 480 gigs free.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Because what I use it for is I download movies and shows. Yeah. So I use Netflix and Showtime Google Play and all of that. And this is my tablet as well.
Yeah.
So I used to carry it kind of both in a sense. And now I just flip it over. When they yell at me on the airplane, turn off your laptop. I just flip it around and it's now a tablet.
Right. Boom.
Yep. They yell at me and I watch a show.
Oh, how funny.
So that's where I'm using
Are you allowed to do that?
They tell you any device below a certain number of inches is what the last couple of flights I've been on. They're like, any small computing device
they're
that's
wise
below
to that
X
trip.
Number of inches.
Here's another. The Apple people would scream if they have the large tablet. No, it's the tablet. Right. As long as they don't see the keyboard, they're fine.
But here's another thing that's amazing. So you can run mobile apps full screen on a laptop. For example, I love Snapseed.
Yeah.
Right? But I run it full screen.
Because it's an Android app.
It's an Android app.
And because it's from Google, they've optimized. A lot of apps are not optimized for your screen.
But a lot of them are. A lot of apps are on full screen. And it's so great because sometimes mobile apps are the best thing out there.
We should have had Tofu on this show. Yeah. He would be so happy to hear all this.
I know.
With machine.
Yeah.
One problem is that Netflix and often Amazon Video do not run well. They get confused. It's not optimized for
DRM
Android on
issue. Chrome. That you got to blame DRM.
It's a real problem still. Whereas Google Play is optimized for it and what operates beautifully, but Showtime, Netflix, and Android stuff is really difficult. I have to restart often to get it going, or it gets confused.
Yeah,
and that's the only problem I have.
There are other Google apps that are not optimized for the Pixelbook and do not even run.
The Washington Post is not very good.
And there are other problems. I mean, the MacBook Pro, the fit and finish, and the all that stuff is superior for sure. And the Pixelbook's performance is kind of a mixed bag. It's everything's on a hair trigger. Like you think about touching a key and all of a sudden you see the letter on your screen.
Yes.
You're like, I didn't even. And so that's.
Well, actually, Mike, it knows what you're going to type.
Yeah.
You've witnessed the next internet and the next Google.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's right. Telepathy.
You just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, my point is that people talk about, the Pixelbook is inadequate because it's not a business machine like Windows. Windows is optimized for business. It's not a content creation machine like a Mac. The Macs are optimized for content. How about the internet? Is the internet important? Because this machine is optimized for the internet.
I would agree with you on that, actually.
Well, I think it's optimized for business, too. If you look at the Grab and Grow program that Google's pushing, that's on the rundown.
Yeah.
It's kind of fascinating. It's you're hoteling not just your desk, you're hoteling your computer.
Mm-hmm.
And you just go in and pick out a Chromebook. Who cares what Chromebook it is?
Yeah, I do like it.
Doesn't
that.
Matter if it's
it doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah.
I had I did one of my favorite horror stories in business is that I did a presentation once with this executive of a major company I won't mention, and he was in the middle of an acquisition and had all the details locally on his hard drive on his laptop. And but he was like holding on to it. He wouldn't check it.
Yeah.
You know, he carried it on.
Handcuff bracelets.
And the airline lost his carry-on luggage.
How?
Let that sink in for a second. There was no room in the overhead compartment. They said, don't worry, we'll take it
for you.
Yeah.
We'll put that in the
closet. He never saw it again. And the whole time we're doing this presentation, he was like distracted. He's sitting there going, oh my God, what have I done? His career was over. So this grab and go is an example of the fact that
it
doesn't matter what happens to the hardware.
They have Google employees can go up to a kiosk and they just take a fully charged Chromebook and they log into it. It's got everything on it. It's their Chromebook. Then they bring it back. It erases it and they're done.
Yeah. And they're extending this to the world. So this has been
in companies.
I remember
this.
When they were
for education.
When they were pushing Chromebooks, there were little kiosks at the airport. Right. You could borrow a Chromebook and then get off the plane and
which
give it back.
Which is a great idea.
I wish they would do more of that.
But essentially, this is a program that's been dog-fooded in Google.
Where
and now
else are you going to see this?
Enterprises. It's now a program companies. That they're rolling out to enterprises.
Oh, wow.
Have you seen, Mike, the HP X2, which is the separable screen?
Yeah.
I have the Windows version of that.
And it's nice, but the problem is that is what Mike's saying about the level of hardware. It only goes to four gigs right. on it. And I want at least 8, if not 12, so I can run the 60 tabs, but not as many as that. Stacey, don't worry. So we need more competition at the high end of this. Everybody thought the Google was crazy making a high end machine.
Yeah.
And I think that, and I'm seeing all the tech guys now all coming late to the party saying, gee, this is why you can actually give up your Mac. And this is, you know, boy, the Chromebook's actually okay.
What's funny
and
is
a
that,
lot of, yeah. of burning bush late conversion to my religion, I might
yeah,
add.
Yeah. Well, within a year or two, Mac OS and iOS are the only platforms that won't run on the Pixelbook flawlessly. I mean, you run Windows, you'll run Linux, you'll run all this stuff, Android, and it's just going to be
in virtualization
Well, in the case of Linux, Google is working on it.
I've been using that, and I really like it's command line only, but it does help me a lot because I can run some basic programs that I really need.
There's an enormous amount of energy around making these things work at high performance.
The idea of putting Windows on this just makes me feel ill. Yeah. My friend Bill Gross at Idea Lab buys a top Mac laptop, and then he converts it to Windows, which just throws me.
Yeah, it's good hardware, but I don't know if I'd want to run Windows on it.
I wouldn't either. But the point is that if you're a developer or something like that, and you want to, or a web developer, for example, and you want to see how it looks on Windows, you can just flip over to Windows, check it out, go back. It's the point is that if it's your main machine and you're a professional, and especially if somebody else is paying for it, you definitely want the Cadillac. You know what I'm saying? You want to max out on memory and storage, because within the next couple of years, there's going to be a lot of stuff you can do with it, even if you can't necessarily do a lot with it now.
So, Stacey, are you converted to the religion? You ready to go out and get a Pixel?
No, just that I am wishing that, Mike, I want to edit your story because I think
take a few minutes. Go for it.
I'm like, you underplayed this. You focused too much on the Chromebook extensions when it's really about the future of the internet, and that's just an example of where you could go with this.
Yeah,
because I think you're right with the where it could go. I do think extensions are really pretty complicated for most people. They're basically a harder version of apps in a lot of ways. People haven't learned to trust them the same way. So
I'm trying to change that. I really think extensions are one of the most underappreciated things out there.
I agree with you.
So fantastic.
I want you to make a list somewhere.
Okay, I will.
Elgin.com I'll publish it somewhere and just say.
Yeah, you've got to do your list, Mike. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, seriously, just send it. I mean, should you want it, Kevin has aboutchromebooks.com, so you could even send it there.
You could publish
or you have your own site.
Yeah.
Or both. You got me thinking about the Chromebook. And I have to say, the Pixelbook is light. It's thin. It's actually a beautiful design. It feels good in the hand.
Look at this.
It's a really nice product.
It's a lovely, lovely machine.
Yeah. Scandinavian design.
Oh, here's the other problem, Mike. I have two.
Yeah.
I would kill to be able to run Skype on it for this show.
Yeah.
Well, that's a Microsoft
Mac here.
Issue.
I have to borrow a Mac in the office. I have to take my Android tablet runs Skype well because it's native, and I can use that, and I've fooled Leo and Carsten a few times and run it from the tab. but actually, if I try to run it for my Pixel,
we need to find a Pixelbook analog for Skype. We could use that.
Wait, what about the Microsoft Hangouts Surface Go for Skype? Because didn't that just
I don't want to carry another machine.
I'll have that next
this
week
is my
if,
machine.
You, if we could, we could talk about it. But I think Mike's right that Windows is probably is a little too bloated. It's designed for business applications. It's not the right answer. What I think we need is a Skype analog that's a Chromebook extension. I don't know if that's Hangouts. I don't think it is.
Hangouts. Google Duo.
Duo doesn't even run on the Pixelbook.
Yeah, isn't that odd?
Duo for Android doesn't run. So it's one of those Google things that doesn't run.
This is the drawback on this is you're a little bit dependent on Google.
Yeah, I am anyway. So
right.
Yeah.
I live la vida Google.
Yeah.
It's fine. Follow the light. Pixel. Come use your Pixel.
Prime Day was a great success.
Everything's okay.
Even though Amazon went down during Prime Day.
I didn't know they had so many dogs. Did you?
About the dogs?
When you get a failure, they show this is one of the Amazon dogs. And there's like
I haven't seen
there's
that.
A cockadoo.
There's a lot of them.
Or whatever. And yeah, there's a lot of them. I didn't know that before.
I kind of, like Stacey, avoided Prime Day. We feel like it's amateur hour.
Yeah.
But were some really good deals. They sold 100 million products in 30 hours.
Consumerism is still alive. That's crazy.
Still alive. It also made Jeff Bezos briefly the richest man ever to live in the world. $1.5 billion to $2 billion in revenue estimates. Gross merchandise value topped $3.5 billion. This is according to RBC Capital Markets analyst Mark Mahaney. Company did not provide sales figures. Some pretty good deals, including $750 for the base model Pixelbook.
Yep.
But the number one device sold, as we would expect, was the Amazon Fire TV Stick. People love the Fire TV Stick. Mostly because they
get pirate TV
on it.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
What fascinated me about this was how it brought up other retailers, competitive retailers.
Jeff,
that just amazed me. They've made a new holiday.
They made Christmas in July.
Well, as I pointed out in a blog post yesterday, I think if you have a Chrome extension, every day is Prime Day. There's an extension called Camel. You've heard about this.
Camel. Yeah, I love it.
There's several others that will basically, when you're on Amazon, with the extension, you just click a button when you're on Amazon and says, well, here's where you should buy it. Go buy it over there. Right. It's like half price. And so
I got to start using all this stuff.
Yeah.
Prime Day boosted this is what Jeff was talking about, other large retailers' sales by 54%. So
amazing.
What happened? Yeah. You know what? I think this is probably, you can thank the Wirecutter and Thrifter and other sites that when Amazon Prime had a deal would say, oh, but there's a better deal at Walmart. And I bet you that's where some of that traffic came from, is people just saying, all right, I want to buy it. Let's see where else I can get it. Maybe they use Camel.
Yeah, it gave people an excuse to shop. And what happens is you're like, oh, this is a smoking hot deal. And then you're like, is it? And then you're like, right. No.
Walmart slashed prices.
But also, it also motivated the other retailers to put on great deals.
Yes.
Walmart. And so the consumer won all around. Now watch. They're going to go after Amazon next in Europe, I predict. Next American company, huge American company, richest man in the world. They're going to say Amazon's evil.
Amazon's really a U.S.
No, not yet, but they're going to watch. You just watch, Henry Higgins. You just watch. It's helping consumers.
One time we landed in Venice and we started driving north, and along the side of the highway you see this building start, and you're driving and you're just like, well, there's still building is continuing. I keep driving. Like, that's like an Amazon building. Other end, Amazon.
Wow.
Massive warehouse.
Amazon workers struck in Europe during Prime Day. So this is the problem. is European workers...
This
is Europe. Because, of course, conditions in Amazon warehouses are not ideal.
Yeah.
And they decided to take the advantage of the big day to have a two-day strike.
Turn the screws.
Yep. I don't know how that affected Prime Day.
It can't be worse than Amazon's site going down, which apparently was fine. So
now, all right.
Again and again and again.
Maybe this is pure Alex Jones, but... Do you think it's interesting that during the biggest day, Amazon has more bandwidth than anybody? There's no reason Amazon couldn't anticipate and handle all the traffic they got, that their sites went down. I got to say, if you're going to hit America, you hit it where it counts.
You're not going to take your shirt off, are you, Alex?
Let me tell you!
We had heard last week that there was a lot of chatter about the Russians attacking the United States. Of course, the president's denied it, so I'm not worried about it.
I get that people could not shop for their stuff and Amazon is sad, but that's not...
It's probing. Here's what they did in Ukraine. They took the power grid down for a few hours. What's the harm? Mm-hmm. It's a probe.
That's actually harmful.
Yeah, it is harmful, but honestly, it's not as harmful as it could be. What you want to do if you're weaponizing hacking tools is test them.
Yeah.
Figure out what capabilities you have. That isn't the final result, absolutely. But if you could take Amazon down, if you could take not just Amazon but all e-commerce down, if you could take the internet down, if you could take the grid down, you could do some serious harm.
On the other hand, it basically teaches your foes to figure out how to protect themselves against those kinds of things.
That's true, too.
And so, you know, this is why I think that the Russian hacking is often ill-advised, because they're essentially training.
They're telling you.
They're training everybody how to protect themselves against, you know, because when they really want to bring everything down, everything will be patched, fixed, et cetera. So I'm not sure.
The worst deal on Prime Day, according to CNET, $2,630.52 for a used paperback. Apparently, some Amazon sellers took advantage of Prime Day to hike the prices.
Oh, yeah, because if something ran out, you might automatically grab it.
You might not pay attention.
Did anyone buy it?
Deborah McGillivray, author of romance novels, you may recognize these titles, such as One Snowy K-N-I-G-H-T, noticed her book was being listed as high as $2,632 with free shipping.
But the shipping was free,
yeah. While other copies were selling for $99. She tweeted that out. Scott Lady Writer. There's nothing illegal about someone listing an item for sale. Actually, I have a friend who sells air purifiers on Amazon, not molecules, somebody else. And he makes them. He has his name imprinted on them. He has them made in China, sells them using Amazon Marketplace. But he noticed Amazon undercutting him, selling the same thing, selling his with his name on him, undercutting him, and then jacking the price way up. Amazon's automatic pricing routines are very aggressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Andrew actually has done a lot of research into this because he's been looking at doing that sort of business model. So if you ever want to know more about this.
Do you want me to hook him up with my friend? Because he has a lot of anecdotal stories about ways Amazon helps and hinders.
I think it's so
fascinating. This book last
night. Like raw capitalism.
Yeah, yeah.
it is.
Unfettered.
So I got Michiko Kakutani's new book, The Death of Truth, last night. And then today I got an email from Amazon saying I just received a $3.20 refund on it.
What?
Hmm. Oh, did you pre-order it?
I pre-ordered it, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, that happens to me a lot.
Oh.
I'm a big fan of the pre-ordering.
We have a couple of really good internet history triangulations coming up this Friday, day after tomorrow. I just wanted to let you know about at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. We're going to talk to a documentarian who's got a new documentary. I've been watching it on General Magic. That's fascinating. General Magic, as you know, Mike, because you were probably covering Silicon Valley at that time, was a bunch of people who had worked on the Macintosh who were desperately trying to find something as earth-shattering. And 5 years later, Apple spun off General Magic. Bill Atkinson, Andy Hertzfeld, Mark Porat, Tony Fadell was there, who later went on to create the iPod and the Nest company. Andy Rubin, the creator of Android, was there. These are some big names. Megan Smith, who's now Google, of course. It's a John Sculley. It's a really great documentary. We'll interview the director of that documentary. And then after that, I'm very excited. We're going to talk to the author of Amazon Smile. No, the author of... I'm glad you're giving money to Smile. That's good. The author of Valley of Genius. This is the uncensored history of Silicon Valley. In interviews with some of the most interesting, the best people, I cannot wait. Alan Fisher will be in studio with us for that interview. So if you're interested in Silicon Valley history, two really good interviews. That's going to be at 3, right, Carson? 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. That is on Friday.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah. And I'd like to get Michiko Kakutani on. Talk about that.
So hold on one second. I was going to get something.
And Jeff wanders
we're
off.
We're losing Jeff.
I was like, is that wine?
Well, have a little more wine there. This is good, but I'm drinking a little faster than you are, Mike Elgin. So
so the book adds into a pile I have here, if I may.
Yes.
We have a book called Post-Truth. We have a book called Truth. We have one called
Post-Truth. After Truth.
And we have one called The Death of Truth. Orwell on Truth.
Oh, my God. Are you doing
a
thing?
The Unreality Industry. We have, it is the responsibility of intellectuals to speak the truth and to expose lies.
That's a long
We
time.
Have post-truth, and we have
How many
a short history
are there?
Of the truth.
Wow. Michikiko Kakutani was a New York Times chief book critic.
Brilliant. She's brilliant.
And so I can't, that's another one we'd like to do. What is wrong with truth? What's going on with truth, Jeff?
Yeah, exactly.
What's the latest with truth?
So today I did a conference. I spoke at a conference, investment conference. And before me, they had on a company that, I wish I had the name of it because it was really cool, that's going to do live meditation in groups of similar people.
Oh,
I got to find this. It was really interesting. So they had the guy come on, and of course he did a spiel about the company, but then he had the whole room, including, you know, venture capitalists, except one who wouldn't stop typing on his laptop, meditate. So that came on right before me. So it was everybody was calm and mellow and full of joy and all that. And then I had to follow talking about fake news. So I got up and I said, I'm so glad we're all so calm and mellow and joyous right now. But you gotta, the world is falling apart. You're effing this. It was great. It was just great. It was just, the whole room. What was the name of the company? It was Journey. JourneyMeditation.com.
So they do meditation. EY or EE?
EY, Journey, as in taking a journey. And so they're going to do so they're arguing that all the things that exist now on meditation are, sorry, I didn't mean to go off on this, but it was kind of fun, are recorded things. This would be live, and so you'd be in a meditation session with a guy, you know, a guide with other people at the same time. Does that sound cool or dumb?
It does not sound productive for me.
I do believe that meditation in a group with people is more effective than being alone.
That's what they argue.
Other people, but I'm not sure that transmits over the internet via IP, does it?
It's not really a group, is it?
No, I don't think. Sounds cool, though.
We live just up the coast from the best meditation retreat. I just love it.
Which one?
Down in Ocasio. I can't remember the name of it now. But Jack Kornbluth is Arrested Development, isn't it? Cornfield, maybe. I had a little too much wine, I think.
Who needs meditation?
It is Jack Kornfield. It is what is the name of it? It's Spirit Rock. Thank you, Carson. Knew what I was talking about. Thank you, Carson. This is really a great place if you ever want to go. And it's group meditation, and Jack and others lead it, and it's a guided for the most part, and it's really.
Why is it better to work in a group than on your own?
The vibe, man.
The energy.
The East Coast doesn't understand this.
It's the vibe. Yeah.
No, we don't.
Yeah. Oh, did I mention we're all naked?
No, you did not.
No.
Don't. You know what? Don't mention that.
We're not. But Jack
sounds like a sauna to me.
Jack is an amazing guy. But anyway, I don't know why I decided to do that plug, but there you have it.
I have no idea how I took myself to meditation. I don't know.
Here's one that'll just piss Stacy off. The case against teaching kids to be polite to Echo.
Here's another column she's going to want to edit of mine.
you didn't make me mad. I just was like, I feel like you're saying something, but I wasn't sure, Mike.
Oh man, you really have the editor's hat on. Get this woman a blue pencil.
I'm sorry, Mike.
You talking about this one or the other one?
No, the other one.
Let's talk about this one.
The case against teaching kids to be polite to Echo. When parents tell kids to respect AI assistants, what kind of future are we preparing them for? I happen to have been saying this all along.
Really?
Yes.
I think you both are silly. I think it's important because we're already anthropomorphizing these guys, right?
Yes.
These assistants. I think it's very important because kids can't distinguish between them to have them learn how to be polite to them.
I think it's very important to teach the kids to distinguish between them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I'm not arguing. I don't think it's a false argument to say that those are opposite sides of the thing,
right.
opposite sides of the fence or argument. But especially when they're young, I do think it's important for them to have empathy for things, everything. Even dogs, cats, you know.
How about the toaster?
Even the toaster.
They should not.
How often has a child, a toddler, gotten mad at something and slapped it, and you're like, no.
But the reason for that is that it's property that belongs to an actual person. It's not because there's anything about the toaster that's going to be offended.
Kids don't understand that. We don't make that distinction until they get older.
Okay, you got a point, Stacey. I kind of agree with you. Okay. And at the same time, though, we really do – one of the things kids need to be taught because they're going to enter a world where this is going to be an issue is the distinction between humans and machines.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. That's been well understood up until now.
And also, when if your daughter is typing in Google Assistant, for example, and just says, "What's the weather?" You're unlikely to say please. If she says the exact same thing to a Google Home device, you might say, "Oh, you should say please, thank you, all that stuff."
Because it has a human voice, right?
Exactly. So we're already being tricked. We're already waving the white flag, basically. By teaching our kids to number one, treat virtual assistants with respect, possibly deference, and even to a certain extent, obedience. For example, Mattel was working on this project that was canceled because it was so offensive, where it was like a virtual assistant, it was like an Amazon Echo for children, but it wouldn't do what the child asked unless the child said please. In other words, they would teach kids that it's appropriate for machines to judge and scrutinize human behavior and to decide whether the human behavior was acceptable before it would do. That's what we were teaching kids with the Mattel thing. And I think
they canceled that. And that wasn't the goal was to teach kids to not be little jerks. It was the same reason you have toys for children that say, you know, that reward, not whacking, like the turtle toy that, you know, if you beat up the turtle toy, it stops for a while. So I would argue that forcing a child to say please in order to make something happen for a mechanical object is not great. But teaching kids not to be jerks to things that we're already anthropomorphizing is probably an okay thing to do.
Okay, so the future of these devices have cameras. So will we insist that the kids say hello when they walk into the room? Do we want these devices to tell the kids to take their elbows off the table? Where does it end? I say
it depends on what you want them to be taught. Like if I want my child not to put their elbows on the table, enforcing that through a camera enabled device, maybe it would be like, "Oh, your mom says not to put your elbows on the table."
Oh no.
Yeah, no. See.
I think that would be horrible, but you could totally do it.
Well, it's also like the escalator telling you how to go down the escalator. I'm sick of that.
Here's what Mike points out in his article, and I think it's really a good thing. Why do we have manners?
Yeah.
Tell us, Mike. Why do we have manners?
We have manners because we're guarding the feelings of people and we're showing respect for other people. And I think that it's very important that we should tell kids that it's okay to talk to Alexa in the same way that they talk to a jar of peanut butter, in the same way that they talk to the refrigerator.
They shouldn't throw it across the room.
Exactly. Just because it simulates. So here's the biggest point that I think I may get you on this one, Stacey. We have to prepare kids for a future that includes being polite to other people, but we also have to prepare them for a future where everything is fake. They're going to have virtual reality. They're going to have real fake videos. They're going to have fake Instagram celebrities. They already do, actually.
Yeah.
And so the kids have to be prepared to understand the difference between the things that simulate humanity and the things that are humans.
And that's going to be harder and harder to do.
And so this is a teachable moment that Amazon Alexa is basically identical to a toaster. It's a thing. It's a property. It's not a person. It doesn't have feelings. You can't hurt its feelings. If you want to be polite, that's fine. If you want to be rude, that's fine. It doesn't matter. It's an appliance. That's the lesson we should be teaching kids.
Okay. What this conversation and the story, though, is missing is a perspective from someone who's aware of developmental stages in kids. At a certain age, kids cannot tell the difference between fantasy and real life up until about the age of 5. So trying to teach them that lesson before then is useless. So making your kid or asking your kid to treat, you know, your robot civilly and not whack it like a kid is supposed to do or a kid does is fine. As they get older, having that in play, I think having those discussions and distinctions between real life and other things, I think is important.
I think you're right. I think before 5, you're teaching them a habit. After 5, you're teaching understanding. I agree.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Leo. That was a very succinct way of putting it.
I think that's
so. Yes, it just depends on your kid and how old they are.
Yeah.
And where they are in the Piaget stages of comprehension. I think that's reasonable. Because you're teaching them the habit of saying please and thank you. Before 5, it's just a habit. Whether they say it to Mr. Moon or they say it to you, it's just a habit.
This is one of those rare things that there seems to be a sort of universal belief that kids should be polite to virtual assistants. Other than Leo, pretty much everyone was saying that, yeah, you should be polite.
No.
And I'm just trying to say, wait a minute. What are we, right? What else are we teaching? That's it.
This came about because some people saw that their kids, like their two and 3 year olds were like, Alexa, give me this.
Yeah.
And yeah. They were like, I don't want to train. Then they started treating their mom and dad like that.
That's not
give me
good.
Juice. Well,
but then you made it, give them the distinction. The other thing is maybe children need somebody that they can bully. Maybe that's just something they need.
Whoa.
You might be in the minority on that.
That's a dark side of you, Leo.
Kids have. I mean, like, I'm sure we all had imaginary friends, and some of us have imaginary. I had two.
I still do.
I had twins. One was the good twin, and one was the bad twin, and it was Cindy and Dindy, and I can't remember who was which. But, like, one, I was free to treat like a total non-human. I think she ended her life being pushed out of an airplane.
Wow.
And the other was, like, your good friendly side.
So you needed that, right? You needed. I had Keiki and Delarina, and Keiki. I don't remember which was evil or not because I was too little. But yeah, I think you need that. There's a dark and light side, right? And you need somebody that you can express your anger to safely.
That's Google. Everybody just yells at Google.
Yeah, we just yell at Google. God, I love you guys. You know, you really. I think it's great to have you on the show today.
Was it illegal once upon a time to drink while on the air?
In radio, yeah. It's probably still
it was. Okay, yeah.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. Well, you're not supposed to operate a transmitter while under the influence.
Is that what radio was, operating a transmitter?
It really was. You had to get a license to if you wanted to be on the radio when I started, you had to get a license to operate the transmitter.
You got to start licensing
that
podcasters.
That was the job. Radio telephonic license third class.
Yeah, Howard Stern talks about that. He did went the whole way, got the license and all that. You had to learn Morse code, all this stupidity.
And our engineers
to learn Morse code
in the studio have their. This is just to know we are legal. Wow. This is John's Federal Communications Commission radio telephone third class operator permit. His restricted radio telephone.
I've seen him operating radios.
Huh? With the broadcast endorsement. With the broadcast endorsement. Very important.
Wow.
I don't have mine. I wish I had mine still. This is expired in 1982, John. I just want to say.
Get a little lapsed.
We are not in compliance. No, it really was. You were, wait a minute.
Oh, here we go. Here's
There's
one.
More. There's more. Oh, wait a minute. I have my, and also framed, I might point out, this is my United States of America Federal Communications Commission amateur radio license. So wow. I am legal to operate this microphone.
But not professionally.
No, only amateur, and only in amateur ways.
I have a California driver's license. Does that help?
I think it's hysterical. We have these framed, John. What is... No, it's good.
In the 80s.
I remember taking a train to New York City, and you had to take a big test. Oh. It was a big deal.
I had no idea.
Anyway, you guys.
Speaking of the FCC, just for a little thing.
Real quick.
Is Ajit Pai seeing the light? I mean, he's got doubts about the Sinclair Tribune purchase.
Oh, God, I hope
so. People explained to him that he was just
riding
a dead horse? No, he was,
beating the dead horse.
Beating the dead horse.
He was sodomizing the dead horse. Whatever it was, he shouldn't have done it.
The horse was not happy.
The horse was unhappy, and the rest of us were just appalled. So, really, he's saying that? I think that's lip service. We shall see.
Well, some are saying it could put the deal off entirely. That's what amazed me, because Pi does all this.
Sinclair, which is a big local television holding group, is also famous for requiring its anchors to spout Trump propaganda and all sorts of things. They're trying to buy, what is it, the Tribune Papers? What are they trying to buy?
No, they're trying to buy Tribune TV stations.
Okay. And and they've adjusted their bid. So one of those would be the giant KTLA in Los Angeles. It's a $3.9 billion deal. And Wednesday, Sinclair said it planned to back off part of its proposal. To satisfy rules that forbid a single company to own airwaves on such a dominant scale. A good law, I think, a good rule.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. Sinclair previously proposed selling off 23 of its TV stations after the deal was completed, but several of those stations would still effectively fall within its operational control. On Monday, Ajit Pai said he had serious concerns with those divestitures. On Wednesday, the company said, well, okay, we'll sell two of the stations, one in Dallas, one in Houston, through an independent trust.
Not enough. Not enough.
Yeah, you really don't want a concentration of especially local media power in one or two hands. That's right. We saw it happen in radio, and it just killed radio. So,
I thought video killed the radio star.
That too.
I'm so sorry.
Podcasts killed the video star. Venmo. I like this story because I've been complaining about this for years. When you set up Venmo, all of your transactions are public, and this is obvious, but a Berlin-based researcher analyzed more. There are 200 million public Venmo transactions from 2017, 1 year. And, with the API, you could see the names of every user. You could see everything they spent their money on. She said she was able to learn an alarming amount about them. Now, the key is that Venmo is public unless you set it private. Hmm. So the reason I bring this up is just to remind everybody, if you're using Venmo, there's a setting. You have to go in and do it. I don't know why it's public by default. It's kind
You don't know why?
Why? What is your benefit? What does PayPal get out of that?
More information. I mean,
well, they get the information public or private. Anyway. Why are they publishing it? Maybe they say, look at all the people doing fun things with Venmo.
They can use that data. They probably can sell that data if you have it made public.
Get it anyway, though, don't they?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of them say if you opt in, we can do the following with your data.
Yeah. But when you open Venmo, the very first thing you get to is a Twitter-like public feed of all the things people have spent doing on, you know.
Yeah. It's that gamification angle. And I would say, remember when Fitbit, there was a while, probably a couple of years back, maybe 2013, when everyone freaked out because their Fitbit trackers could tell when they were having sex?
Right. Right.
So this is...
What I want to know is why Eric paid Daniel for lip service. And that's all I'm just saying. You know, a lot of people use emojis now. Kiana played Tammy for Ken's accident charge. Apparently, Jesus was at the club with Chris, and this has helped pay the bottle service. Weston paid Elizabeth. I'm on that sugar daddy type stuff, he says. Oh.
A lot of people, there are a bunch of stories about fun transactions. People tag these.
It is fun to read.
Creative.
It is fun to read. I like reading it, but maybe you want to consider.
The sugar daddy stuff should be private.
Some stuff should be private.
Well, no, they're not. It's not really what they're buying it for. They're just, some people.
Yeah, you're right. They play with it. No, I did that. I do that too. I make up stuff. Yeah.
Right, because wasn't there a while back, there was like the story about people's Venmo accounts getting shut off because they would be like, this is for the anthrax, and the agency responsible for tracking terrorism and banking transactions kept shutting them down. So,
according to Quartz, hackers account for 90% of login attempts at online retailers. I don't need to say more. That's it. That's the story.
Isn't that amazing?
What
percentage of successful logins?
That's another question.
Giving stupid one-off stores like Macy's when they're like, oh, make an account with us. I'm like, oh, man, you know you're just going to lose this. Couldn't you go through someone I trust like Amazon?
I'm just going to mention, we talked to them about doing advertising. They say that we don't have enough money to do it, but I'm going to mention it because I love it anyway. Privacy.com lets you create credit cards for any purpose. Hmm. One-time use or only merchant-specific use. You could set a limit per charge. I wish they would buy ads, but they say we don't have the money. So I'm just going to give them a free plug.
Let me understand. So it's literally a credit card?
It's a debit card. So here's the thing that people might worry about. It ties it to your bank account or to your debit card. So it takes the money right out of your checking
account. But you're not changing your credit rating by having more credit.
No, it's not a credit card.
Once you open a credit card, you're supposed to never close it.
It's not a credit card. And it's effectively like you're creating debit cards. You can make up a fake name and fake address, so it's private.
And you can buy Facebook political ads.
You could do, that's a good point. Privacy, I guess, knows where you are, who you are. But anyway, I use this all the time because for that reason, I don't want to, I want to be more private on these on these sites.
Capital One have something like that?
Yeah, Capital One, part of that sponsorship thing? They were also, they bought an ad. Yeah, we were down there doing a panel for them at South By. And Capital One does that as well. So okay. I do that if you can, because those one-time use cards really protect you in a variety of ways. And actually, yeah. I've been using my Apple Watch all the time. Same reason, because the merchant doesn't get any private information about you. I mean, Apple does, but I think they're a little more trusted.
They know you're an Apple Watch user.
Right.
So
that's it. That's the information they got.
Everything you need to know right there.
I think we should wrap this thing up. Do you want to mention the fact that Netflix's numbers were a little weak? I think this is not a big story. It's certainly
not a big story at all.
Yeah.
I was at this conference today, and a competitor said, oh, they ain't dying.
Yeah.
They only grew
by several million, you know, big deal.
Exactly. They still grew hugely.
And
right.
Actually, Reed Hastings said, you know, the problem is our prediction algorithms aren't very good. We project a certain growth, but we often don't deliver. It's happened before. And, you know, that's more a problem with the projections than anything else. Netflix shares fell 14%. The stock market's jittery. The company only added 4.5 million international customers. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Only 1.2 million U.S. customers. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Their estimate was 1.2 million. They only got 670,000 new customers in the U.S.
So, Leo, have you bought your ticket on Bezos's rocket?
$200,000. And, you know, you don't. I think a better deal would be buy some rides on the
Vomit Comet.
Yeah, that's only $5,000.
Right.
Still see, what do you get? In Bezos's rocket, you get to float for a few seconds, and you see the curvature of the Earth.
Is there a lower price for Prime members?
Only if you vomit the Whole Foods.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Oh, that's what they should do. That should be like, you know, for the first person who spends $10 million on Prime, they get a seat on the rocket ship.
Exactly.
That would be an amazing promotion.
And here's a blast from the past that I'm old enough to remember. Instapaper.
Yeah.
Instapaper, yeah. Arco Arment's company, was sold to BetaWorks in 2013. Pinterest owned it for a while, and now they've entered an agreement to transfer ownership of Instapaper to a company owned and operated by the people who have been working on it since it was sold. The employees. Instapaper was like Pocket and allowed you to save articles. Yeah. I used it for a long time. I still use it. I loved it.
Yeah.
But if you're in Europe, because of GDPR,
exactly.
They had to pull it back, and they still haven't gotten a GDPR version. So is that what killed it as a good venture for Pinterest? I don't know.
I don't think so. I mean, I was in Europe. And it was really frustrating because I use it just as a bodily function. And it was so great to go to Switzerland. Suddenly it worked again. I'm like, oh, my God, because, you know, Switzerland is not in the EU.
I read on the blog post that it started working again in Germany. So they may have figured out how to be GDPR compliant. I switched to Pocket many years ago. Yeah. Although it's funny, I logged in after reading this story to my Instapaper account. The last thing I posted was 5 years ago. Yeah. It's fun, though, to read, you know, one of the articles I have on here. Is how Dave Morin rejected a $100 million buyout offer for Path from Google. I think looking back, you might
Google Plus story?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. What has Twitter become? This is 6 years ago on the O'Reilly radar. Mike Lukides said, oh, man, Twitter, it's all over because they pulled back the ability for third-party developers to write Twitter apps. It's fun to read the old stories. Bring back some of the memories.
I'll select the name of the new company, Instant Paper Inc.
I get it now. Oh.
Get it?
Instant Paper Inc. Here's an article from the New York Times, how companies learn your secrets. Ooh. It's actually been updated. Interesting. Anyway, let's wrap things up with picks and tips and numbers. Let me start with Stacey Higginbotham, the host of Stacey on IoT, the Stacey podcast at StaceyOnIoT.com with Kevin Toefel. What do you got for us, Stace?
So in my never-ending quest to connect everything via voice, specifically Madame May, I'm showing you guys. I do not have this yet because, again, I'm not in my home for the next couple
weeks.
Because your
June would be jealous.
Well, this is a different function. This isn't actually for someone like me because I don't think I've made a microwave meal in like years. But this is a connected oven from GE with 3,000 pre-programmed meals. So you scan your meal into the app and the oven knows exactly how to cook it and will do it. You can also tell it to Madame A, turn on microwave. And what's significant here is, well, there are two things. One, this would be great for a dorm room or something. Yeah. Somebody's so lazy they can't read the instructions.
Echo, make popcorn.
But two, they have created a native support for basically this microwave, which is amazing. So you no longer have, GE has a skill called Geneva. So you used to be able to, you used to have to say, Madam A, ask Geneva to turn on oven. Now you just say, Madam A, turn on microwave in this case.
How do they do that so without a skill?
It's the same sort of, it's basically like native support. So
do you have to have Amazon's cooperation to do it?
Or? Yeah, you work with Amazon and you create the ontologies for like what the device, it's a data schema for connected devices. So what is this device? What can it, what are the basic functions it performs? And you pre-program that and then anybody building that type of device can use it.
Right. So they've and got Amazon would have to approve it, I would guess, right?
Yes, yeah. Amazon builds it with them.
I see.
And then,
that's cool.
Yeah. So thermostats, locks, lights.
That's one of the big negatives of Echo Skills is you have to say open task and then do it. And
you have to remember how
it's
to
a
do
lot
it,
to remember, yeah.
And this is really cheap. It's $140 for this microwave.
Yeah, it's really cheap.
I don't know. I mean, I
think microwaves are cheap. Microwave. They're just big radar like, guns, right?
Yeah.
I don't think they're expensive.
No, not anymore.
This has got everything. Smart sensor, easy, clean interior. 0.9 cubic feet, 900 watts. It's kind of a mini dinky microwave.
Yeah, I say this is for like your bachelor or college dorm
room.
You can
make a cup of soup with it.
Leo and I are old enough to remember when people debated whether to get microwaves.
Radar ranges, they called them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so Freescale has a new type of oven technology, or now it's ST Micro. It's an RF-based technology. They just put in a Miele oven. It's actually pretty sexy.
Don't tempt me again.
You got to do it, Stacey.
I got that tuna.
That's hot.
That's hot. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
I can't believe I left that on the table.
Mike Elgin, your pick of the week, my friend.
Okay, well, remember back in the day when the internet was fun?
Yes.
Okay. Years ago, the internet
was
fun.
We thought it was going to change the world for the good.
Yeah, we were wrong about that. But,
okay.
But it was fun. And so I have a newsletter called Mike's List, and where I always have, I seek out really fun websites.
Oh, fun.
So I just thought I'd share.
You're the new stumble upon.
Exactly. I am. After this wine, yes.
So, stumble out the door.
The first site is called GeoGuessr. It's GeoGuessr, but no E-R. It's just R, like Tumblr.
Okay, GeoGuessr.com. I'm looking at a landscape.
Yep. So this is a game based on Street View, Google Street View, where it plunks you down in some place in the world.
And you guess where
you
it is.
You have to figure out using clues. You walk around in the environment and try to figure out where you are.
I'm thinking Vermont. Oh, where am I now?
Probably not.
I'm in a desert road.
Yeah.
This is not...
Can we walk to the other side of that sign?
Oh, yeah.
Is it exactly, only in the U.S.? Or
you can move around. It could be anywhere in the
world. Oh, let's go see the sign. Yeah. Stacy, you're good at this.
I'm a secret agent in my spare time.
Oh, we're at the railway crossing.
All right, so we're in an English-speaking country.
Yeah.
That is not how the U.S. does their signs.
It's not? Let's see what this let's see what this sign says. This is fun.
South Africa.
Yeah.
Oh, so maybe, yeah.
For those of you listening, we're in a Google Street View-like environment.
And it is Street View, isn't it?
It is Street View. Yeah. It's Street View photos, etc. And the sign says, it is not a sign.
It says railway crossing.
Okay.
Stop on red signal. I don't, you think that's not the U.S.?
No, that looks like the U.S. I was going to say there was an angular sign back there that was in a, I think it was a yellow sign. If it was a yellow sign, then it gives you a...
The power poles look different too.
Crossing.
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
So English. So okay, so that's a really fun.
Let's walk
actually.
Into town.
Yeah. Wait, so can you give us the answer?
It's like 100 miles.
Do I? Can I get the answer?
No.
Is it? How do I know? How do I know?
Wait, there's a truck. License plate.
Let's ask the driver of this truck. Hey, he's driving on the left.
Must be
you might have been right.
No, Australia.
We're not going to catch up because it's a different photo.
I can't catch him. Jeff, what? I don't understand. Why not? How does it work? How does this thing work? There we go.
Okay.
So zoom in. Don't click. Zoom.
Oh, you know what? You know, they're gonna
blur the license.
They blurred it.
Yep.
So zoom in.
Yeah.
Enhance. Center.
And
zoom.
It says
country... What the hell does it say? Let's zoom in again. Country energy. We're in the country.
That's a funky looking truck.
It's a funky looking weird truck. Okay, can you ask it?
No, Australia.
I think Australia.
It's got to be Australia, but it's got to be, yeah.
Queen Bayan, Australia.
How do you know that?
I Googled country energy.
Uh-huh. Oh, my God. You're too smart for this game.
Really fun game.
Well, I thought we had to New work South from Wales. The image.
So, no, apparently we should teach Jeff how to treat images.
Okay, couple more fun sites that are really fun. Another one's called Take Me Back 2.
We had too much fun with this.
You put in a date or a year.
Yeah, yeah.
And it gives you all kinds of information about what was happening on that day.
I don't know. They use cookies. Is that okay?
No, that is not okay.
Take me back to...
Yeah, so...
A date for me? My birthday. My birth year.
Okay.
Can I go to the day?
You can go to the day.
Oh,
you can go, yeah.
November... How do you spell November? 29, 1956.
Okay, so it's going to be lots and lots of information. This is great for writers. For example...
it was Thursday. Sagittarius. The president was Dwight D. Eisenhower. Famous people born on this day. Yvonne Forvarg and Hinton Battle.
They must have more famous people than that born on this day.
The 7th Cavalry was the most viewed movie.
So you get old newspapers, the front page of a newspaper.
This is really cool.
Hit songs that were, hits at the time. All kinds of stuff.
What the sky looked like?
If you're a novelist or you're a writer, this is a great way to paint the picture about what was happening in the culture.
Man, movies were crappy in 1956.
They were terrible. Terrible.
Terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why
I have so much fun looking through the old New York Times.
Yeah.
This is really a great idea. And then you could click here for a personalized message. You could send this to somebody.
So this is a fun site just to mess around with. One
is
more
it
site
in the UK. It looks like it might be a little biased toward the UK.
Right, I don't know.
Here's discover how the US looked. Oh, look at that. Santa in Claus 1956, this is how the US looked.
Santa Claus was in Santa Monica.
Florida welcomes you. There we go. We have a picture of
racism.
that's
it was racist.
About it.
Everything was racist.
There was Santa Claus on the beach and racism. That was it. Okay.
It was a crazy time, man. The third one is a site called Starring the Computer. So,
we're having too much fun.
You're watching a show and you see an actress or an actor and you're like, whoa, what else were they in? Well, this is that.
Yes.
For computers. So you see a computer and you're like, what computer was that? And it will talk about, and it rates the movies and TV shows based on how accurately they portray the technology.
Oh, my God. This is the nerdiest thing ever.
It's absolutely.
Did you know that the one laptop per child appeared in the film Savages?
I did not know that.
I did not. As well as an Apple Unibody iMac and a Panasonic Toughbook. Look, Sleeping Beauty. She's got an iMac.
Man. Somebody needs a life.
Somebody.
Yeah. No one bring this up at parties or casual conversation. I think that's really important. This should come with a caveat.
I've already got kids. I don't care.
Oh, man. This is kind of fun. This reminds me of one of my favorite subreddits. It's a Unix system where they show clips from the playback of various computer screens and movies, and they're so stupid. They're so bad.
And giant fonts and
stuff. It will spoil movies for you, basically.
Yeah.
I was watching a TV show the other night, and I noticed the guy's supposed to be on a webcam, but it says .jpeg in the name of the frame. It's like, you didn't... Okay. Okay. They're very nice. So how do I subscribe to this fabulous newsletter? I don't think
this is a really old school. It's just a website. You go there.
Mike's stuff at Elgin.com?
Yeah.
So
Mike's List. Elgin.com/Mike's List if you want to get the newsletter.
He used to send it out as a newsletter.
It is. No, Mike. Oh, okay. Elgin.com/Mike's List.
Okay.
Free newsletter, weekly. It's a lot of fun. It's basically all the irresponsible, stupid, ridiculous, dangerous things in technology.
In other words, it'll give you hope.
Exactly.
Once again.
Exactly.
Mike's List. Subscribe. The best tech newsletter ever published.
Ever.
Thank you, Michael.
Ever.
Do you have a number for us, Mr. J?
I do indeed. No, I just lost it. So, I lost it. There it is. I actually, Quinn Nelson, who makes videos about technology online, I saw this come across. And it's one of those ridiculous surveys that some company just does, but I couldn't resist. So in a survey of 1,500 single people, 65% of iPhone users are inclined to consider a first date with an Android user, but only half of Android users would say the same about an iPhone user.
Yeah, who are the snobs now?
What? That's fascinating.
Well, iPhone users are kind of obnoxious. Yeah, so I'm sorry. I got to say it.
There was a couple years, like 3 years ago, there was a story about people who were on dates or like Tinder dates when you were trying to text with people to see if you wanted to go out on a next date. The people who had iPhones were judging all the Android people because they're, you know, how your text bubbles are different colors if you're in one phone or the other. Yeah. So they wouldn't date the Android users. So that's actually counter to this, I'm sure, very legitimate site.
Well, it comes from Tinder users. A site that sells your old tech called Declutter. So maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I'm doing the major caveat.
They're trying to
more than a third of men feel a cracked screen demonstrates a lack of personal care and financial security.
I agree with that. I will not date somebody with a cracked phone.
I just think you're a teenager if you have a tech. I mean, I've never seen a teenager with a non-cracked screen.
No, they're all cracked.
Some people like people with cracked phones. They want somebody who's willing to make mistakes.
My daughter cracked her phone. She didn't want me to fix it because she said, no, that's privilege. She said she wanted to show she was a person of the people.
Oh, my.
With her cracked
I don't think the
phone.
iPhone is the people's phone, but okay.
Actually, I don't know if it was an iPhone. It might have been, you know. She gets whatever I'm not using. This is my pick of the week, and it's kind of an oddball pick. This comes from a Stanford research study. It's called Almond, and you can download the app on Android. You can run it out of the website. It's a virtual assistant that knows odd things like get a cat GIF. It'll do that. There's actually a whole list of commands. You could tweet the latest NASA astronomy of the day picture. You can auto-reply to my emails. You can do some if this then that stuff, like when a file changed on my Dropbox, email it to me, or when I've used more space in the Dropbox, let me know. Holidays, iCal events. They're trying to, I think the Stanford group, oh, by the way, and one of the things I really liked, it works with LG WebOS TVs, which includes my TV at home. So I can use Almond to turn the TV on, to mute it. But what's interesting, this is an academic project using Thingipedia. It's an open virtual assistant and crowdsourced because Thingipedia is crowdsourced. So, for instance, when the Bitcoin price reaches $20,000, search for a Bitcoin picture and tweet it with the caption, I am rich.
Huh.
Now useful. How much would you pay? Isn't that cool? You'll find it at almond.stanford.edu. It's a creation of the computer science department at Stanford, and they're obviously very smart people trying to do some interesting things with natural language.
It's nuts.
Yeah. Thingpedia itself is part of their, they call it the Mobi Social Computing Laboratory at Stanford University.
Hmm.
Oh, who was it? Which one of you guys? I think it was Jeff. Doesn't believe in gamification on social media, or sorry, psychological manipulation on social media.
Yeah.
Was that you, Jeff?
I think. In what way? I don't know that I.
Or that it was an issue. Maybe it wasn't you. Okay.
I'm in favor.
You're in favor of manipulation on social media. No, someone was arguing that it wasn't a big deal.
Really?
On one of our shows. But it wasn't Jeff. Okay. Never mind.
I don't know who would
say that. Sounding familiar. God knows what I say. Yeah. But I used to drink on the show.
Mm. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, I think everybody has a pick. Everybody has said their say. This was a really fun show, not the least of which because we enjoy to find Pinot.
Bottle's not empty. The show's not over until the bottle.
It is baseline, and you can have some more if you'd like. I'll let you pour.
Okay.
Because I'll just get it all over the place. We do This Week in Google. It's my last show of the day. My weekend has now begun. We do This Week in Google on Wednesdays, about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. That's 20:30 UTC. See, I can still do math. you can watch it live streaming at twit.tv/live. We have audio and video there. You can also download episodes of any edition of this show from our website, twit.tv/twit. Best thing to do, subscribe in your favorite podcast application. That way, the minute it's done, we push it out, you will get it. You'll have it, and you can listen to it at your leisure. You can also, and I've been saying this a lot more lately because I think it's kind of cool. One of the things I love about these voice assistants is it really has been good for podcasting.
Yeah.
Because you can ask for a podcast from almost any of the voice assistants and they'll play it. So if you say, listen to This Week in Google on your Google Home or your Echo or your even your Carmen Carden Cortana-based device or your HomePod, it should play.
Yeah.
The most recent episode.
It'll sound great.
It'll sound great. And, you know, it's I've always said if podcasts were as easy to listen to as radio, we'd have a shot. And I think they are now. Mm-hmm. So that's a big change. Don't forget Stacey Higginbotham's IoT podcast. She does it with Kevin Toefel every week. You can find out more and sign up for a newsletter at StaceyOnIoT.com. Thank you, Stacey.
You do have to ask Madam A or Google for the Internet of Things podcast.
Yeah, that's the one little thing you have to know what, but that's always the case. The Echo,
you have to know what it's called.
Echo, play the Internet of Things podcast, and that should be enough. Sometimes you have to add on TuneIn. I don't know why on some of our shows.
Yep.
There's an issue with some of our shows playing it in a group, in an Echo group. We don't know. We haven't been able to figure out what that's all about because other podcasts you can do it. I don't know. Podcasts actually now are easier than listening to the radio.
Why does radio exist? I know you have a show.
Who needs radio? When you are browsing around on the internet, I might invite you to visit gastronomad.net. That is Mike's other website, and it's his enterprise that he does with his beautiful and talented wife.
Yes.
Amira Elgin.
She is beautiful and talented. We just did a Prosecco experience. There was a lot of people who wanted to do that, and we didn't have the room. We're doing another one.
Yay.
In October. So if you want to go to Italy and experience heaven on earth and some great wine and food for a week, go to gastronomad.net, sign up, go to experiences, and you will be very happy, I guarantee
it. Oh, you're going to do New Year's in Mexico City?
Yep.
That will be fun.
Yeah.
So, and you're doing more Prosecco. I guess that was
Prosecco
popular.
In Provence next year. Very popular. I mean, people just were ecstatic.
The Cava Barcelona experience.
Another Barcelona. This time we're going to be in the wine country and go into the city instead of being in the city and going to the wine country.
Oh,
so,
man, I'm so jealous.
Sign up, folks. You're going to love it. I guarantee it. And
there's small groups, right? How big is the group?
6, 8, 10 people max. Prosecco was 6 people plus Amir and I.
Wow, that is special.
You get really good treatment. And Mike and Amira go there. They learn the area. Yeah. They learn about who the interesting cooks are and winemakers, and you get to meet them.
That's right.
We introduce many a great meal
to all of our friends there, and it's just very family oriented, very very fun. Stay up late, having great conversations. It's just fantastic time.
Nice. So. Really would love to do that. I we're going to do one of these for sure. Jeff Jarvis is, wait a minute, I have it here, the Leonard Tow Professor for Journalistic Innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. Plus, as if that weren't enough, the director of the Tow Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. And
he always wanted to direct.
He is at buzzmachine.com. That's his blog, at Jeff Jarvis on the Twitter. And I'm glad you're back. We miss you when you're not here. So thank you for... returning to us, Jeff Jarvis. Thank you all for coming back and watching the show. We love doing This Week in Google. I hope you enjoy listening, and I hope you'll be back next week. Take care.